You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
Good morning, this is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the May 9th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the KZWAX phone lines to get your takes on the world. Yesterday, 3 days ahead of a congressionally imposed deadline, President Trump formally withdrew the United States from the JCPOA. The agreement, largely negotiated by Secretary of State John Kerry and signed in 2015 by Iran and the five members of the UN Security Council plus Germany, that ended Iran's nuclear enrichment program and included an inspections regimen that precluded Tehran from initiating a nuclear weapons program before 2025. Ironically, Trump delivered his message standing before a portrait of George Washington, who in his farewell address warned Americans against having, quote, passionate attachments, end quote, for foreign nations. Our first president, I suspect, could not possibly have anticipated the passion that Trump and so many members of his administration, not to mention Congress, have shown for Israel. But then again, Washington probably couldn't have envisioned that the desires of a future generation of wealthy Americans to spend unlimited amounts of money to purchase the votes of members of Congress and shape the decisions of his presidential successors would be considered by the Supreme Court as free speech and the law of the land. The headlines of two Israeli newspapers summed up the president's action. Defying world, Trump says U.S. withdrawing from Iran nuclear deal was the headline of the online Times of Israel, while the venerable Dedi Haaretz's English edition headline said, told the story in its anticipated outcome. Quote, Netanyahu doctrine, Bibi's fix-it-or-nix-it moment on Iran is finally here. After nearly a decade of trying, the paper's Anshul Pfeffer wrote, Netanyahu is finally about to see the U.S. administration adopt his doctrine toward Iran. But can it work, he asked. Well, that's what I'll be inquiring about later in the program when I speak with Sasan Fayez Manesh, professor emeritus of economics at Cal State University Fresno, author of Confronting Iran, Obama's Policy of Tough Diplomacy, and more recently an opinion piece on Counterpunch, Trump, Iran, and the Fate of the JCPOA Nuclear Deal. Stay tuned for that interview at 20 minutes past the hour. Trump's performance yesterday was predictable. After a brief introductory sentence, he launched into the mantra that has become the standard fare for Israel's political class, its lobby in the U.S., and Trump's speechwriters that, if passed as prologue, will go unchallenged by any mainstream journalist. Quote, the Iranian regime, said Trump, is a leading state sponsor of terror, clearly reading from a teleprompter. It exports dangerous missiles, fuels conflicts across the Middle East, and supports terrorist proxies and militias such as Hezbollah, Hamas, the Taliban, and Al-Qaeda. Over the years, he said, Iran and its proxies have bombed American embassies and military installations, murdered hundreds of American service members, and kidnapped, imprisoned, and tortured American citizens, end quote. The evidence supporting most of these claims is either non-existent or flimsy. They largely date back 35 years to 1983, when Hezbollah formed in resistance to Israel's occupation of Lebanon following its invasion of its northern neighbor the previous summer, ostensibly to drive out the PLO. Since that invasion and the casualties of destruction it caused have been erased by the media from the American public's memory, the president's description of Hezbollah as an Iranian proxy and as a terrorist organization has no domestic challengers. If the U.S. allies and NATO do not share Washington's designation of Hezbollah as a terrorist organization, it's something you're not likely to read or hear. What you're most likely have not read or heard is that Hezbollah and his Shia Christian and Sunni allies scored major gains in Lebanon's parliamentary elections on Sunday as the main Western-backed faction headed by Prime Minister Saad Hariri lost a third of its seats. As the Associated Press reported, but few U.S. newspapers printed, quote, the results of Sunday's election further bolsters Iran's allies in Lebanon and neighboring Syria at a time when Tehran faces growing Israeli threats and the prospect of the United States pulling out of a landmark nuclear deal negotiated with world powers. They also underline the growing clout of the group in Lebanon, where it dominates politically and militarily, the AP story noted. Hariri acknowledged that the losses at a news conference in Beirut on Monday, but said, quote, it's not the end of the world. The international community said should look at the results in a positive way because they reflect democracy in Lebanon. He blamed his losses on a new election law and a performance by his political party that was, quote, wasn't up to standards, end quote. As for Trump, he has clearly fulfilled his campaign pledge to tear up the Obama administration's signature foreign policy achievement and re-implement sanctions against Iran and any country doing business with Tehran. But in doing so, he went against the advice of his Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, the hawkish House Foreign Affairs Committee Chair, Ed Royce, Washington's three most important European allies, and almost two-thirds of Americans who believe the U.S. should not withdraw from the deal, according to a CNN poll released yesterday before Trump's announcement. Trump made it obvious for some time that he is determined to undo as much of what Barack Obama accomplished as possible. In addition, notes the Loeb blog's Eli Clifton, quote, the sheer perversity of his personality may well explain today's action. But, Clifton goes on, it may also be useful to follow the apocryphal advice that Watergate's famous deep throat offered Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein and all the president's men, particularly in the unbelievably corrupt swamp of the Trump era. Indeed, suggests Clifton, yesterday's unpopular announcement may have been exactly what two of Trump's biggest donors, Sheldon Adelson and Bernard Marcus, and one of his biggest inaugural supporters, Paul Singer, paid for when they threw their financial weight behind Trump. Marcus, owner of Home Depot, and mega-billionaire casino owner Adelson are board members of the Likud-supporting Republican-Jewish Coalition. Both have already received substantial returns on their investment. Total alignment by the U.S. behind Israel, next week's move of the U.S. embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, and the official dropping of the term occupied territories by the State Department to describe the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Adelson, as I have pointed out before, was Trump and the GOP's biggest campaign supporter. He and his wife Miriam contributed $35 million in outside spending to elect Trump, $20 million to the Congressional Leadership Fund, a super PAC exclusively dedicated to securing a GOP majority in the House of Representatives, and $35 million to the Senate Leadership Fund, the Senate counterpart, in the 2016 election cycle. Whatever most Americans think of the president, there is no question about his popularity with most Israelis. Yesterday, Jerusalem Mayor Nir Barkat announced his intention to formally name the square near the U.S. Embassy site, quote, the United States Square in honor of President Donald Trump, end quote. An official event with American dignitaries will be held in the future to celebrate the naming, his office announced. This is the way in which Jerusalem returns love to the president and residents of the United States who stand by the State of Israel, said the mayor. President Trump decided to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of the Jewish people, stand on the truth, and do the right thing. That's the view of the mayor of Jerusalem. While Palestinians in Palestine and around the world are mourning the loss of their homeland, Israel will be commemorating its 70th anniversary next week, and the U.S. Embassy is moving to Jerusalem to coincide with the independence celebrations. It's a strong symbolic gesture, but there are several more concrete steps Washington should take now to help ensure Israel's security and protect its own interests in the Middle East, according to an opinion piece in Bloomberg News. If one of its authors was not retired Admiral James Stavridis, it would not be worth reporting. But since Stavridis happens to be a former commander of U.S. forces in Europe, including NATO, a columnist for Time magazine, and is a frequent talking head on the news networks and NPR, what he has to say should be carefully scrutinized. In the article, co-authored with Michael Makovsky of JINSA, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, who Colin Powell blamed for the Iraq War, we are told that, quote, Israel's very existence is threatened by Iran's nuclear program, which continues in the form of expanded atomic research and ballistic missile development, which are unfortunately permitted by the 2015 nuclear deal. The intelligence trove revealed by Israel last week, they say, confirms Tehran's determination to acquire nuclear weapons capability, not a surprise, certainly, but a clear warning of potential danger ahead, end quote. Even if, as the U.S. media has accepted without a murmur, the existence of a half-ton of documents that Netanyahu claims were pilfered from a secret, apparently unguarded location in Iran, were what he says they are, They confirmed nothing of the sort. If his presentation was made to change the minds of U.S. allies who were a part of the agreement with Iran and who hoped to maintain it despite Trump's attempt to wreck it, he failed utterly. That Netanyahu made his presentation in English has led observers to conclude the dog and pony show was cooked up with and for Trump's benefit, and for the likes of Stavridis and Makovsky, although apparently they didn't need it. But the most important threat, they write, to Israel and the U.S. interests isn't Iran's nuclear program, but rather Tehran's stunning expansion of influence. Its entrenchment in Syria, for example, they write, generates ever greater prospects for a major Iranian-Israeli conflict. Iran and its proxies also threaten America's Sunni Arab allies, seek sway from Lebanon to Yemen, create more jihadists and refugees, put energy supplies at risk, and target U.S. ships and Saudi cities and missiles, end quote. Anyone taking a look at the number and locations of U.S. military bases surrounding Iran can see that this statement is nothing more than Israeli propaganda, but it leads them to the next step. Quote, the U.S., they argue, must support its allies in the growing confrontation with Iran. It should seize upon Israel's longstanding ethos of self-defense and the newfound readiness among Sunni Arab states to defend their own interests and work quietly with Israel against Iran. Washington also has legal obligation to ensure Israel's qualitative military edge over its neighbors, Stavridis and Makovsky point out, which happens to be true. Maintaining Israel's QME, or qualitative military edge, has been a long-standing tradition that every president since Lyndon Johnson has honored, but had not formally become U.S. law until approved by Congress in 2008. For Stavridis and Makovsky, this would best be done, quote, by front-loading the 2016 Memorandum of Understanding signed by Obama, under which the U.S. is providing a record $38 billion in foreign military and missile defense funding spaced evenly over 10 years. That's $3.8 billion a year. A fast-track MOU, they suggest, could allow Israel to acquire a host of weapons earlier than initially planned to meet growing threats from Iran and elsewhere. On their gift list are F-35 fighter jet squadrons, that's squadrons plural, with each plane costing U.S. taxpayers over $100 million, KC-46 air refueling tankers, mobility capabilities like V-22 tilt-rotor aircraft, small-diameter bombs and Hellfire precision munitions, and joint direct attack munition kits that turn unguided bombs into smart weapons and drones and semi-submersible naval vessels. They seem to forget that Israel already is one of the world's leading producers of drones, and that thanks to the kindness of the German government, Israel already has a half dozen submarines that are said to be armed with nuclear missiles. More bewildering is their call for, quote, the U.S. to replenish Israel's precision munitions and other critical wartime stockpiles and consider making Israel a pre-positioning base to support American and allied regional operations. This has, in fact, been the case since the first President Bush created such a base in 1991 in order to placate Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir and keep Israel from participating in the first U.S.-Iraq war. In their air assaults on Gaza in 2012 and 2014, Israeli forces made good use of the pre-positioned weaponry, which was provided free of charge. Finally, at least for this report, they called on the Pentagon to consider relocating two Arleigh Burke-class destroyers from Rota, Spain, to a new home port in Haifa. These ships, they argue, with their, quote, cutting-edge Aegis combat systems, would be well-positioned to defend Europe against an Iranian missile attack, balance the new Russian naval presence in the eastern Mediterranean, and reinforce Israeli deterrence, end quote. The likelihood of an attack of any sort on Europe by Iran is as remote as it could possibly be, and the Europeans who want to do business with Tehran would be the first to say that. But that expression of ignorance, like the entire article, like the pro-Israel sycophancy of the president, reveals the extent to which Washington has surrendered American sovereignty to a foreign country. And add up what retired Admiral James Stavridis, who formerly commanded U.S. forces in NATO, and NATO, I should remind you, and Jensen's Michael Makovsky are pushing for in their article, and the answer appears to be another Middle East war. Finally, a story that relates to this issue that you're not likely to hear or read about elsewhere. On August 20, 2015, the Department of Energy released under the Freedom of Information Act its guidance on release of information relating to the potential for an Israeli nuclear capability, officially numbered WPN 136, that was in order prohibiting any government employee from acknowledging Israel's possession of nuclear weapons. It implied that Israel might not yet even have nuclear weapons, even though a majority of Americans believed otherwise. The official reason for publishing the gag order has never been acknowledged, except that the Symington-Glenn Amendment of 1971 proscribes U.S. aid to any country involved with nuclear weaponry outside of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, which clearly applies to Israel. What's clear is that is one of the reasons that federal employees and government contractors, including presidents, avoid giving direct answers when questioned about Israel's nukes, and why Israel's nuclear arsenal hasn't been mentioned in the Iran deal debate, is because any federal employee who does so can be summarily fired, as happened in one instance, and possibly go to prison. In 2016, Grant Smith of IRMEP, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy and a frequent guest on Takes on the World, filed a lawsuit alleging that WNP 136 was an illegal legislative rule with a single purpose, to facilitate the unlawful delivery of the lion's share of the U.S. foreign aid budget to Israel, a nuclear weapons state, in violation of the Arms Export Control Act. Federal District and Appeals Courts refused to conduct in-camera review of the two-page WPN, despite multiple requests to do so, before dismissing the lawsuit a week ago today. Both courts claim that Smith, the plaintiff, cannot avail himself of the Administrative Procedures Act to challenge the systematic undermining of the Freedom of Information Act for unlawful ends. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news from Palestine and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal military occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. We ask our listeners, as we do every week, were you involved last week in the Palestine-Israel peace movement and the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's savage military attacks against them to force them out of their homes and annex their properties into Israel? Did you speak out on the atrocities Israel is committing every day in Gaza and the West Bank? If not, why not? What is your reason not to?
Professor Joel Covell was professor of psychiatry and director of residency training at Yale College. He has a diploma in psychoanalysis from Downstate Medical Center Institute. He practiced psychiatry and psychoanalysis for 24 years and left those professions in the 80s, partly out of dissatisfaction with the healthcare system. He had been professor of social studies at Bard College since 1988 until earlier this year. He is both a scholar and an activist, published over 9 books, over 100 articles and reviews on subjects including white racism, therapy, against the state of nuclear terror, about Nicaragua, one called Red Hunting in the Promised Land, and his book, The Enemy of Nature, The End of Capitalism or the End of the World, in 2002. He is editor-in-chief of the quarterly journal Capitalism, Nature, Socialism. He accompanied Pastors for Peace as they broke the U.S. blockade on Cuba in their 1994 Friends shipment. And in 1998, he was the Green Party candidate for U.S. Senator from New York. Joel Covell is more information at the website joelcovell.org. I'm John Grebe in today for Sharif Fam on This Week in Palestine, which you can hear every Sunday at 8 o'clock in the morning here on 90.3 FM WZBC Newton. So I'd like to just start out by asking you, Joel Covell, would you tell us in your words, what is Zionism?
Oh, okay. And thank you for asking me to be here. It's both a necessity and a pleasure for me to speak on this subject, and so I'm very happy to take part in this. For me, Zionism can have many meanings, but we have to focus on the main one, which is the ideology of a state which is for one people, the Jewish people, and there's two significant features of that. One is it purports to be a Jewish and democratic state, that is an ethnic state and democratic state, not a religious state at first, but ethnic. And the other is that it purports to be this kind of state for Jews all over the world, so that actually any person of Jewish extraction, which means having a Jewish mother or grandmother, is entitled to a citizenship in the state of Israel. And this is a very large claim, but it is one that plays a very important role in the history of the Jews in the last half century, and also, of course, because it's a state of one kind of person, which is to say not the indigenous people of Palestine, it also excludes these people and it gives them second-class human rights status forbids their return. So every Jew in the world can return to a country, even if there's no evidence at all, as would be the case for me and the great majority of Jews, that his people ever lived there. And no Palestinian in the world can return to the country from which their people have been expelled by Zionist aggression. Zionism is forced to be aggressive, of course, because it makes a claim on somebody else's land and home. And if you want to take over somebody else's home, you've got to play rough. You've got to be tough and mean and unscrupulous and violent. So this is the course of Zionism, and it's had many tragic and horrific implications. And I think it's running its course. I think it's evolving. I think it's going in a direction that is still very, very horrific, very much a tissue of profound human rights violations, but at the same time shows certain possibilities of eventual transformation into an outcome that's worthy of human beings. In summary, Zionism is the ideology that Israel is the state of the Jews and the fulfillment of the Jews, and it is, as a result, an aggressive and imperial ideology.
Joel Covell, would you tell us what was your experience being raised Jewish, and how you've broken with some of those traditions you were raised with?
Well, I was raised in the heart of the Jewish so-called diaspora in Brooklyn, New York, and my family was conservative. Jewish family came from Russia, Ukraine in the early years of the last century. It was a very standard Jewish upbringing. It wasn't a standard family because there was a lot of dissension within my family. My parents disagree on everything, including Israel. My father being anti-Zionist from a conservative position, my mother being ardently pro-Zionist. But long before that became an issue, I was subjected to the Jewish educational process, and I never liked it. I was always a terrific student, loved learning, but I felt that what I was being taught was some kind of a, you know, tribal. I wouldn't have the word tribal, but some kind of, you know, restraining, confining way of looking at the world, and I never took very well to it. And there were other family conflicts which would take a long time to detail, but what happened basically is that by my mid-adolescent years, I decided I didn't really want any part of being Jewish in any kind of religious sense. And eventually, as the state of Israel showed its true colors, I decided I also don't identify with the Jews in an ethnic sense. I'm proud of so much that Jewish people have accomplished under terrifically difficult circumstances very often, but I'm certainly of the opinion that the only way for a Jewish person to be authentic as a human being, much less as, not so much as a Jew, but because it's authentic as a Jew, but as a human being, is to speak out against the crimes of his people, her people, and whether these people are Christian, Muslim, or whatever. My people happen to have been Jewish. I think one has to speak out against that. And I'm what you might call a non-Jewish Jew. I don't have any particular attachment to the religion. I take part in the, you know, I'm a member of a cultural group, but I'm do so from a position of rather extreme rejection, shall we say, of its implications, insofar as these are Zionist.
Joel Covell, I wonder if you would tell us about how you see the significance of the Balfour Declaration in 1917 and the partition in 1947 in terms of shaping what Israel is today, and with an eye toward whether you and other Jewish people did or did not choose to identify with those two crucial times in the 1900s when the State of Israel was defined.
Well, just to back up a second, the Zionist movement, as most people know, but just to get it clear, really emerged out of Eastern European, Central European Judaism in the last years of the 19th century. It was part of a sense of impending crisis in European civilization and also part of a movement towards nationalism, which is a phase in our history, which hopefully we're getting over. But it was one of the possible alternatives to be Jewish. Most Jews were not Zionists. Zionism was a specifically minority point of view, and it was really going nowhere, in part because it's a very extreme and audacious and an immoral project, and most European Jews had no interest in going off to Palestine. Those who did had to adopt a particularly aggressive and ruthless strategy to overcome the huge difficulties. And one of the difficulties, of course, was weaknesses. There was no possible way of military or takeover at that time. And they had no strength to do more than occasionally buy up this piece of land or that piece of land from the Ottomans who ruled it. But what they found they had to do, and this is key, is to ally themselves with an imperial power. And they looked for the Germans, they looked for the Turks, and they got nowhere. And eventually, through a very complex process, they managed to persuade Great Britain, who saw in them basically a useful instrument of European expansion into the Middle East, which was about to go to pieces because of, you know, the breakup of the traditional colonial world after the First World War. So the Balfour Declaration arose out of that with a lot of machinations and a lot of hypocrisy and bad felt faith and the like, and stated that the His Majesty's government views with favor the settlement of and the formation of a Jewish national state in historic Palestine, and then adding with typical British hypocrisy that we understand this should in no way prejudice the situation of the indigenous peoples there, which of course is just an utter lie. It had to do just that. It led to a very long, ambivalent, and complex, and eventually violent relationship between the Zionists and British imperialism, which after the Second World War became the object of Zionist terror tactics to drive them out, which they were eventually forced to do. But at the same time, the Zionists were turning to the numero uno, the number one imperial patron, which would be, of course, ourselves. And that's the chief story today, is the formation of this relationship. It was principally crafted by President Truman because of his weakness, and the Zionists were leaping into the breach and giving him all kinds of support. He wasn't particularly fond of them. His diaries show outrage at a lot of what they were doing. But he was a politician, and this was his ticket to political, you know, durability. So he was just going to play the game, and that game consisted of engineering the United Nations conference in 1947 in such a way that the land of Palestine would be partitioned. This is not the intention of the Palestinians by and large, and it was certainly not even the intention of the U.S. State Department. They didn't want it because they knew it was going to create endless trouble with the Arabs And this is not out of charitable impulses, you understand. The U.S. had decided that this was their prime strategic goal because of the centrality of automobile culture and our industrial system itself and its reliance on petroleum and the fact that the petroleum of the world largely appeared in that part of the world. So big debate in U.S. ruling class circles as to whether to go with the Zionist side or the Arab side, and eventually that debate was settled on the Zionist side, much to the chagrin of a lot of people, even within the U.S. government, but that's the way it turned out. It led to this very long, turbulent, and thoroughly, I would say, bizarre relationship between the U.S. and Israel, which is playing out even now, but it's a long way from running down, but it's still undergoing a lot of crises, and I think it's eventually going to break down, but it's a long way off. In the meantime, we're caught up in the middle of it, and our struggle has to be, if we're interested in human rights, if we're interested in justice, if we're interested in true peace, our struggle has to be against both Zionism and against the kind of relationship that evolved between the state of Israel and this, and our own U.S. government, state of the United States. So that's, a little nutshell there. But the key thing is that Israel, the Zionist movement in general, felt it had to have an imperial patron, could never have succeeded, and will never succeed so long as it does not have an imperial patron, and therefore becomes part and parcel of the course of empire. And there's a bitter irony here, because at the beginning it was considered a movement of liberation. It was a movement to escape Europe with its terrible legacy of anti-Semitism, and it did so, however, by joining Europe and joining up the imperial mission and the colonial mission of Europe.
Joel Coville, you put out a book in 2007 entitled Overcoming Zionism, Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine. Would you tell us a bit about what the release of that book was like? Part of the story is that the University of Michigan Press put up the book, agreed to put it out, and then after receiving an onslaught of what's described as right-wing criticism about the book, about the topic, and your treatment of it, University of Michigan Press dropped the book from publishing it, and has apparently since resumed it. What was that story?
You've told a good part of it, and I'll just fill in some details. The book was published by Pluto Press, which is home of London, England. So it needed an American distributor. And Pluto has had a long-standing relationship with the University of Michigan Press, which had proceeded fairly smoothly. It's interesting, actually, the University of Michigan Press had put out another book, anti-Zionist book, on One State Solution, so they were not by any means a Zionist organization. What they were was a typical liberal, academic press trying to, basically stay within the prescribed limits of political discourse. And my book went beyond those limits. It called for the One State Solution, but did so in a very, militant way, I suppose. But it's a scholarly book, and I challenge anybody to, dispute that. I'd always like to debate that book. But anyhow, it definitely went further than the usual book on this subject. And, the first response to anything that's subversive, and certainly anything that's subversive vis-a-vis Israel, is to just ignore it and make sure that nobody pays attention to it. And that indeed was the case of Overcoming Zionism. I lectured a lot, and it was good. I was getting involved with alternative media such as your own, and that was very good. And I was traveling to Europe, particularly the United Kingdom and Ireland, and that was very good. And so even though there was no reviews, you couldn't get it in bookstores, the New York Public Library didn't carry it. It was months before it even got in the Library of Congress.
Even though there are plenty of books by Pluto Press and distributed by the University of Michigan Press in the United States, This book, Overcoming Zionism, you're writing about this. And we should mention that you're a published author of 9 books.
About 10, actually. This is the 10th.
10th book now.
Yeah.
And over 100 articles and reviews.
Yeah, I wrote a lot. I've always written a lot.
On a variety of different topics.
Yeah, yeah.
Politics,
yeah.
Psychiatry, Nicaragua,
yeah.
Capitalism, social
it's always been,
ecology. And you've been a professor of social studies at Bard College since 1988. So despite all this, your book did not receive any kind of wide reviews. We did review it on this radio station, I should mention, back closer to then. But you ran into this enormous storm of controversy, criticism, and complaints. What happened at Bard College with your professorship?
Well, let me get back to that, but I just want to say that what happened in 2007 was that the neglect and make it go away didn't work, and Pluto wrote me and said, "Boy, your book is kind of catching on, and we keep selling copies even though nobody knows about it. It spreads through the structures of alternative media, and that's democratic communication. That's so important. You guys made it possible for that book to survive. In the broadest sense." But the result was that the Zionist lobby, in this sense I call them the Zionist thought police, realized that it wasn't going to go away through simple neglect, and they were very alarmed by it. And there's a group called Stand With Us. I'll get back to that in a moment. It's important to a point here. Stand With Us, supported by the Wexner Foundation, $800 million. These guys have endless money, and they just started a campaign against it. Mostly internet broadsides and attacks on this press in Michigan, and the press folded. It was incredible. They just gave up and panicked and called my book hate the speech, and it doesn't deserve the rights of the human discourse, and so on and so forth. We were threatening a lawsuit with them, and they were going to lose it big time, so they backed off. But what they then did is break the contract with Pluto, which they could do. So I want to make sure people know that Pluto Press itself, which is a very respectable, although progressive and left-wing house, lost its contract because they couldn't destroy my book, and they decided that they wanted to destroy all of Pluto's books. But the final point of that is that they ended up destroying themselves, because after they lost the contract with Pluto Press and all this whole flack, people resigned from the University Press. The University of Michigan Press at present is more or less a wreck and a ruin, and it's a great university press that sort of went down itself over this controversy. And I think the lessons are very, very important. A lot of them can be learned on the website CODZ.org, Committee for Open Discussion of Zionism, which is really all we're trying to do is to get this subject out. And the tense with my relationship to Bard is not, I have been. I am no longer a professor at Bard. I was let go there early this year. They claim just for economic reasons and because my contract had expired. I wasn't a regular tenured professor, but I had been had an endowed chair. I'd been on the faculty for 21 years. I had, we argued, de facto tenure. I was a very senior person on the faculty, and I was just more or less summarily let go, and that led to another campaign. And
Joel Covell, let me interrupt if I would, and ask you, what were you told by the establishment at Bard College, by the president of Bard College, by people with purview over your endowed chair and professorship at Bard College, about why, after all those years on the staff and faculty and in an endowed chair for years, was it 7 years? You were
no,
let go.
It was about 12.
12. What were you told about why you were now being let go from Bard?
Well, in stages. In the first 10, I was at Bard for 21 years, and the first 10 years were actually very good. They were very supportive of my political interests. But what happened, both they moving to the right and me keeping going as a public intellectual. And then when I started, publishing also my book on eco-socialism called The Enemy of Nature, which is very radical. It calls for dismantling the capitalist system in order to save the planet from ecological breakdown. And they didn't want any part of that. And particularly the Zionist thing, because the American academic establishment is remarkably Zionist. I think we have to be very, very aware of that, and some schools more than others, but to a considerable degree, the president is virtually an official in the Israeli government. He travels there 10 times a year and the like, and he conducts the Jerusalem Symphony Orchestra. He's, you know, sort of conductor, musical conductor, and and the administration, you know, they said basically, well, we're going through this huge economic crunch, but the point was they didn't sit me down and say, well, let's say, how can we work this out? I'm coming towards retirement age anyhow, and I wanted to work out an amicable settlement, which could have been, you know, satisfactory to all, but what I got was basically a pink slip saying, you know, leave your badge at the door and, you know, good luck in your future endeavors. We don't want you anymore. And they started out by saying, well, they don't want you because of the financial requirements. But in order to justify that, they also had to say, well, you don't fit into our educational program. We have a different, you know, vision. And then they started talking about my teaching reports having declined, which was a very dubious proposition, I may say. And the whole process was handled in a very, shall we say, prejudicial manner. Again, you can read about that at codz.org with considerable detail. But
Joel Covell, how long after your book was published did you get this pink slip from Bard College?
Oh, well, the book was published in 07, and so this pink slip was in, you know, early February of this year. So it's almost 2 years. But it's remarkable that when the book was banned by the University of Michigan Press, Bard College, which is a self-proclaimed advocate of, you know, human rights and freedom of speech, did absolutely nothing to protest it. I mean, it is amazing. I got 600 letters from people all around the world protesting it to the University of Michigan, but not one from the Bard administration. And that was a good sign to me that they were obviously in tacit agreement with what was happening to that book. And then other signs and such, which would take us too far afield now, use up the time we have left, so I won't go into it. But the, you know, it's this long, slow process. I lost my academic chair, which is named after the Alger Hiss, which is the chair on the left, showing that Bard itself was on the left in the early years. I lost that academic chair after I published articles advocating a single state solution and deeply critical of Zionism. Almost, you know, like a few weeks after these articles came out, I was told I no longer had a chair. There again, it was that, oh, well, the family, the Alger Hiss family, is not happy with us. You single person having the chair is too political. We want to make the chair more cultural, et cetera, et cetera. But it was all tied in with my activism and my militancy on this subject.
Let me ask you about that and to delve into your book a little bit, Overcoming Zionism, Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine. An interesting comment, a review for the book, Samir Amin, director of the Third World Forum, writes that your book is absolutely fundamental for those who reject the unfortunate confusion between Jews, Judaism, Zionism, and the State of Israel, a confusion which is the basis for systematic manipulation by essentially an imperialist power, the United States, I believe he's talking about, and convincingly argues in favor of a single secular state for Israelis and Palestinians as the only democratic solution for the region. Those are the words of Samir Amin writing.
They're very helpful words, I must say. I'm very grateful to him for that.
This is a solution, as it's often called, or a strategy that receives very little attention in the United States, at least in the press in the United States, but it is a subject of wide discussion in political circles. Instead of the discussion that's always had in the U.S. media in the main, the two-state solution, the idea of one state to exist, secular, non-religious, not a Jewish state, not a Muslim state, and a democratic state. Tell us about why you think that's the most viable solution.
Yes, I'd be very glad to. I also would say that there's been movement on this front also, and your Boston region is a very active center of conflict and contestation. And a number of very strong right-wing Zionist organizations repressive instruments have been coming out of Boston, Brookline, you know, places like Camera and the David Project and all that. But at the same time, Boston was the site in March this year, it was the first national conference on a single state. It was at, you know, it was at UMass Boston, and 500 people showed up. It was a tremendous event, I would say very definitely that Boston was a major forum and a very advanced place, and you should be very proud of what Boston has done in this respect.
Thanks for acknowledging all of that academic discussion that does and can and has happened in Boston and to University of Massachusetts at Boston,
right,
which hosted that conference,
yes,
notably. But Joel Scovell, particularly about a one-state solution and why a secular and democratic state?
Absolutely. My thoughts about this run roughly as follows. The one-state solution is not a blueprint. It's not something that I have a game plan for. You do this, you do that. Because fundamentally, it has to be worked out by the people on the ground. It's not for, you know, some expert at a distance giving his views on the subject. But it is, however, the logical and inevitable unfolding of a basic point of view, which is that our highest principle should be universal human rights. I don't think that any progress, anything good in this world can take place outside of that context and framework. And universal human rights means, of course, democracy in the political sphere, and we understand how much that is, abused in the practice thereof. It means, of course, socialism in the economic sphere and the like. But that's the foundational notion: is that every person, however different he, she may be, you know, individually, has a certain unique characteristic of being human, which gives him or her an equivalent right to the goods of the earth. And so you take an entity such as Zionism, which proposes that there's a state that is for one portion of humanity, and then also says that could be a democratic state. That's totally illogical, of course, and self-contradictory, and leads to all these terrible outcomes. But the only way out of it is to propose a state that's grounded in universal human rights. And a state that's grounded in universal human rights cannot be the state for any ethnic group, cannot be the state for any religious group, and nor even any national group, but certainly not the former, not ethnicity. And national groups are a little harder to define. But it can't be the state for the Jews. And so it has to be a state for all of the people within it, and it cannot be an ethnic state. So that's the point about the single state solution is it has to be secular because it can't advance any religious view over any other, and it has to be democratic because it has to be grounded in universal human rights. That's what I call a strategic goal. It's the goal towards which we move. It's not an empty ideal, but it's a very real ideal, but it's something we have to realize in the world. And you realize it through various practices that are consistent with the universal human rights. And these include nonviolent practices. So it also, universal human rights also includes a notion of nonviolence. And out of that emerges a militant nonviolent struggle against the notion of a Jewish state. And the so-called two-state solution preserves the Israeli or Jewish state in its essence, while positioning it alongside of a Palestinian state, this is not consistent with universal human rights.
Joel Covell, let me just ask you at that point, because a lot of listeners, especially Americans who constantly hear a kind of a line of reasoning by the U.S. State Department and others, will wonder, of course, this idea of a one-state solution, secular and democratic state, flies in the face of all this history Americans have heard for decades about Jewish people having been oppressed, marginalized, thrown out of countries, victimized, and blamed. A very small percentage of the U.S. population, around 3%, a small population of the world population, who want their own state to protect themselves and their own interests from that kind of persecution, which has happened throughout history, being surrounded by Arab and mostly Muslim countries in the area of Jerusalem currently, how could one state, secular and democratic, work under those conditions?
Well, conditions have to be created. The notion of a universal human right and the one-state solution is the political framework within which you work to transform those conditions. I mean, the whole thing is based upon the idea that history is not the aimless repetition of things, that it has a certain goal in it, and that there are things we can do to make the world better, such as, you know, abolishing slavery. He used to say this about slavery. I mean, how could the United States work without slavery, so, and or women's rights or whatever? There are many ideas that have been thrown on the, you know, into the dustbin of history, as they say, because they do not meet the needs of humanity as a living, growing organism. And you cannot simply blindly accept the given. You have to work to transform the given. And the amazing thing is that people around the world are increasingly taking this attitude with respect to the single state. I mean, I know we don't have much time left, but I was, you know, could point out really how the state of Israel itself is headed for a disastrous crack-up, in my view. It's riven with tremendous internal contradictions. The criminality of its ruling classes and its governmental, high governmental officials is phenomenal. It increasingly acts with impunity and extreme violence. The whole nightmare of the Gaza invasion and massacre is an example of that. But what's happening around the world is that this state, which is very aberrant, shouldn't have been there in the first place. It's a terrible idea. Is now being deeply questioned, and it's starting to be questioned on a universal, worldwide plane. And it cannot be questioned unless you get down to the fundamentals of what that state is. Namely, it's an ethnic state that, you know, expands racism and dominates the indigenous population without regard for their basic human rights. So you have to hold that standard to the Zionist state. And what's happening is that the Zionist state is becoming increasingly illegitimate and is being subjected to tremendous campaigns of boycotting, divestment, sanctions, which are taking place around the world. Whole countries of Brazil, like Turkey, in the UK, have been turning away from Israel. Israel is in deep, deep straits. And this is a very active process. This is a process of historical transformation. It's not something you can just sort of sit back and say, oh, my God, nothing ever changes. Things are changing before our eyes. And the question is, we have to work to be part of that change. And the only way you can be part of that change in a beneficial way, in my opinion, but also in the opinion of increasingly large numbers of people, is to say you must overcome Zionism. You must say that, you know, this is a very bad idea. It was a bad idea for the Jewish people as well as for everybody else, and its time is passing. And I think that's happening around the world.
Joel Coville, in the studio with us is Ken Barney.
Oh, hi. Good friend of mine.
A friend of yours and also a local activist around Palestine Solidarity since about 2002, who's had a previous career in teaching and counseling and psychology and social sciences, having worked in the mental health industry. And I want to welcome Ken to the program. Ken has his own questions for you.
Sure.
Hi, Joel. How are you doing?
Greetings. Good morning.
Hey, listen, there's not a whole lot of time and too much to talk about, but maybe you could say a word about some of these more recent developments, the huge thing that happened with the publishing of Mearsheimer and Waltz work, you know, and very recently the Goldstone Report.
What do you mean what happened with what the work signified?
Well, I mean, you know, with respect to this wall of ideology that we're fighting here, you know, the appearance of Mearsheimer and Waltz's book, you know, was a big, you know, very important event.
Right.
And you recently reviewed this.
Yes, right.
You wrote a really excellent review. I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about the importance of the Mearsheimer and Waltz critique of the lobby. And then also there's, you know, the Goldstone Report now recently.
Oh, yeah.
and the Moyers interview. And the,
right. Well, I'm glad you bring it down to that level, because we sometimes we can get lost in these abstract actions, but they're fought out on the ground over these very, you know, real developments. You want me to respond at this point? You want to add to that question?
Well, no. However you want to talk about that, maybe also even mention something about the Jon Stewart show recently.
Right. Well, that's okay. That's a bit much too. All right. Listen, Mearsheimer and Waltz represent a rebellion. a rebellion within ruling elites of the United States. They represent something called the realist school of foreign policy, as against the neoconservative school of foreign policy. They represent an effort within U.S. elites, because they're very, very mainstream influential academics at Harvard and Chicago, University of Chicago. To say that Zionism and the Israeli lobby have headed U.S. policy in the wrong direction, and that specifically, I think the turning point for them was the Iraq War and the whole Bush administration. People don't quite appreciate that the neocons in the U.S. government that took such tremendous control of U.S. foreign policy during the Bush administration were, if not universally Jewish, there were many of them were Jewish, but the more important point is that they were universally Zionist, and the Zionist ideology entered the inner circles of the U.S. Foreign policy establishment in a way that had never been the case before. And if you look at a better book than Mearsheimer and Waltz, a book by Jonathan Cook of the U.K., who said, Press, it's called Israel and the Clash of Civilizations, you'll see how instrumental Israel and its lobbies were in fomenting the Iraq War. Not that the U.S. didn't want it, but the point is that the U.S. who wanted it was also very deeply embedded in this kind of Zionist worldview. So what they were doing, Mearsheimer and Waltz, was trying to break up the hegemonic power of the Israeli lobbies. And that's a very good thing, and they took a lot of flack from it, and I think that they, on the whole, handled themselves very well, and they're part of this process that I was trying to talk about earlier, namely that with the passage of time, the notion of Zionism becomes increasingly question and dispute, and not in no more bizarre and real sense than from the Israel lobbies, which basically determine U.S. foreign policy and U.S. Congress. I think it's one of those shocking developments in the entire history of the United States, is to have our congressional and also executive branches so deeply under the influence of an essentially foreign power, although it's a foreign power that also is deeply embedded within our own, you know, inner structures. So it's not a simplistic way of looking at things that I'm advancing here. Anyway, so I think Mearsheimer and Waltz did a good thing. But I also feel it's necessary to go well beyond their position, because their position still was first of all, embedded in U.S. foreign policy, namely of a realist sort. And I think, you know, it's just a question of different means to the same end, which is U.S. strategic control over the petroleum reserves of the world and the U.S. The full spectrum dominance over everything. With a more, you know, legal and liberally acceptable veneer. And more to the point, they felt that the lobby related to Israel as though Israel was like, or should relate to Israel as though Israel would be like a normal country, and you should just treat Israel, you know, like any other country. Well, of course, I think you should treat Israel like any other countries, but you should also recognize that the reason Israel is not treated as any other country is that there are things about Israel that are very, very troubling and highly dangerous to the world in a way that Mearsheimer and Waltz just simply either do not recognize or do not treat of in their book. You know, because they never they don't really discuss the Israeli nuclear armaments. They don't discuss the some of the aggressive and violent acts that Israel took. Israel was always a cat's paw of U.S. Imperial policy in South Africa, Iran, when the Shah was in power, and certainly throughout Central America. All these things are indications that you're not just dealing with an ordinary country here. And Prime Minister Netanyahu, when he spoke to the UN a few weeks ago, said, you know, we're not a normal country. Well, he's right. They're not a normal country. It's a very dangerous, nihilistic country, and Mearsheimer and Waltz sort of bend over backwards to try to normalize Israel in their book. They say, we're pro-Israel. We want Israel to be a healthier country. Well, Israel can't be a healthier country so long as it has the ruling Zionist ideology of being a Jewish state. And that's my point and contribution. The Mearsheimer and Wall people say, in effect, well, you know, well-meaning Jewish Americans got carried away and built this lobby that gives unfair advantages to Israel in the, in the court of, the U.S. public opinion. They don't say that that AIPAC, which is the central organization, American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, is actually an illegal organization. They don't say that the U.S. that the Israeli lobby is illegal, which it is, and they know it is, but they don't. They try to sort of normalize it. How is it illegal? There's a law on the books called the Foreign Agents Registration Act. FARA. It's been on the books since the 30s. It's been revised, but basically it says that if an organization is a representative of a foreign power in the United States, it has to register with the U.S. Treasury Department, and specifically the FBI. And it has to make its books and records accessible to the Treasury Department and and the Foreign Service and State Department, whatever, you know. It's a very definite law that's on the books that you're not supposed to simply allow an agent of a foreign power to have, a free hand. Well, the whole point about the Israeli lobby is that the an agent of a foreign power, namely the Israeli lobby, has a free hand. And not only has a free hand, it controls great chunks of the U.S. Congress.
Joel Cavill, I apologize for having to interrupt you, especially in the middle of an explanation like this. It's just past the top of the hour, and I'm sorry, just run out of time.
Right.
Thank you very much for joining us today, and I want to let listeners know they can find out more about your work and your recent book, Overcoming Zionism.
Have placed themselves in an elitist attitude to tell the rest of us what we need. And the truth is, we don't need them to do that. They haven't got the right to do that. They think they do, because they think we're just a bunch of stupid cattle. And I got to tell you, for the most part, most people prove them right all the time. Not intentionally, but because the knowledge, the truth has been withheld from the people. And that's how they manipulate people, is by withholding the truth and controlling them with the lies.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Harvey Proctor, Cliff Richard, under new data protection laws, is it becoming impossible for the press to tell us when they're being raided by the police? Mark Watts, he's the investigative journalist who arguably broke the story that led to the setting up of the National Inquiry into Institutionalised and Westminster Child Sexual Abuse, the so-called VI Paedophile Inquiry. Yes, the National Inquiry is now on to its fourth chair, Alexis Jay, and apparently, as he explains, not being run by her, but by the Home Office lawyers from the very government department the inquiry is supposed to be investigating. Alexis Jay ran the Rotherham Inquiry, which decided not to prosecute police or social workers after 15 years of child sexual abuse in the city, mainly of children in local authority care homes. Thousands of crimes reported to police, but no prosecutions. Also, the exchange of fire between Iran and Israel after Trump pulled out of the JCPOA-Iran agreement, we hear from Israeli Prime Minister's office. And MEK, the French-based terrorist group supported by Trump's new lawyer and former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani. It's like ISIS in Iraq and Syria, hell-bent on toppling the Iranian leadership. We find out why some terrorists are such good guys, we give them British taxpayers' money. Also in the House of Commons this week, on the same subject, the White Helmets, terrorist filmmakers and media medics get a robust defence from Prime Minister Theresa May. Maybe we'll start with that, Martin. The White Helmets, we did have a chat a couple of weeks ago to the daughter of the former ambassador to Egypt, Vanessa Bealey. Who are the White Helmets in Syria? We keep hearing about them on Channel 4 News, and what's their role been?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, they're essentially a front organisation for Al-Qaeda in Syria, and they're funded by the British government and the US government, and they operate only in Al-Qaeda-controlled areas, and in actual fact, they've got no medical or other training to rescue people at all. If you actually look at the videos that they film, professionals, medical and first responder professionals say, well, this is just it's just a load of amateurish stuff. So of course at Douma they walked into the hospital, said shouted out chemical attack and started spraying people with water, but all the evidence coming out of Douma is that there was no chemical attack. They were just basically making it up. And previously, of course, they've been involved where there has been a chemical attack, but it hasn't been carried out by the government of Syria. It's been carried out by the Al-Nusra Front, which is Al-Qaeda Syria.
It's almost like a Red Cross ambulance turning up and a whole bunch of guys getting out with machine guns.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's pictures of white helmet, the same people, the same personnel. One picture, they've got a white helmet on. The next picture, they're brandishing a Kalashnikov, because they are actually, and they were set up by James Le Mesurier, who's an ex-British Army intelligence officer based in Turkey. And they've been turned into this so-called, basically a front organisation for Al-Qaeda. And, of course, the Western Intelligence Service, the Turks and the Saudis, have been working with Al-Qaeda since the 1980s. And
well,
they're still working
as a result,
in Syria.
The American Congress has pulled the funding on the White Helmet. So let's have a listen to how that was put to Theresa May at Prime Minister's questions this week.
Matthew Pettycook!
Mr. Deputy Speaker, despite the ever-present threat of death from both Syrian and Russian airstrikes, and in the face of smears and disinformation, the rescue workers of the White Helmets have never stopped saving the lives of their fellow Syrians. Last week, the Trump administration froze their US funding. with thousands of civilian lives at risk. Will the Prime Minister step up, pledge the government to plug the funding shortfall that now exists, and ensure these heroic rescue workers can continue their work?
Yes. Prime Minister.
Can I say to the Honourable Gentleman, we recognise the very important and valuable work that the White Helmets are doing. They are, as he says, doing this in horrendously difficult conditions. They are incredibly brave to be continuing that work. We do support them. We will continue to support them. And my right honourable friend, the International Development Secretary, will be looking at the level of that support in the future.
Well, what's interesting is that because of the information that's been put before the US Congress, that they are in fact a front organisation for Al-Qaeda, Trump has been forced to cut their funding. But the British, of course, are still funding and arming Al-Qaeda in... We're not just funding the White Helmets, of course. The SAS are based in Al-Tanf, and they're training these people to... what are Al-Qaeda? We've been working with Al-Qaeda since the 1980s, since Operation Cyclone. We're still working with Al-Qaeda. There is actually a real civil defence organisation.
So you're part of the smears and disinformation.
No, we're the ones telling. We're telling the truth about what's going on. Al-Nusra Front is Al-Qaeda, and the White Helmets only operate in areas where they are in control. And the personnel there's actually personnel who cross over from being militants to being so-called helpers. Now, there is actually a proper civil defence organisation in Syria affiliated with the International Civil Defence Organisations, which actually does rescue people. They work mainly in government-controlled areas because they can't get into areas controlled by Al-Qaeda because the SAS are in there helping Al-Qaeda to bring the country to ruin. So of course, you've got tens of thousands of outside fighters from outside Syria who've been sent in by our military to fight the Syrian army.
This fight is taken to Iranian forces inside Syria and in Iran itself? Obviously, there's been terrorist attacks within Iran.
Yeah.
Just a few months ago, another attack on the Iranian government offices with a lot of people killed. What's going to happen as this battle between Israel and Iran starts to grow in the next few weeks, months?
Well, it's very dangerous. Very dangerous indeed.
I mean, we've got American, British, French special forces in Syria. Yeah, Where will they be going? What will they be doing?
Well,
who will
at
they
the
be
moment,
helping?
What they're doing is retraining former ISIS militants to be infiltrated into the so-called SDF in northern Syria. And, of course, they've always been providing logistical and other support to the Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists who are operating in other parts of Syria. And that is not something that started yesterday. The British armed forces set up Al-Qaeda in the 1980s.
I think it's
That's
time.
Why we've got the biggest number of Islamic militants in Europe based in this country, because we were the people that set all that up.
Well, before
and
we
we've
hear,
been still,
Martin,
we're still running it.
Martin, before we hear from the Israeli Prime Minister's office, let's have a listen to Professor Alexander Azad. He's this professor at Saddleback College in California, talking about this terrorist group MEK, which has been being supported for decades by the West, and their object is to kill as many people in the Iranian government as possible, and yet they're being supported by us, but particularly by the French.
Rudy Giuliani is a very, very nasty lawyer. He was the mayor of New York for quite a few years. He tore up New York. I mean, the people in New York are very liberal, very leftist. He tore that town down when it comes to politics. He regularly lectures in front of a terrorist group in Paris. They're called MKO, Mujahideen Khalq Organization. These are people who killed Americans in Iran before the revolution. And because they have a very strong lobby, they've been taken out of the terrorist list. Rudy Giuliani had a hand in that. John Bolton, the new NSA, National Security, had a hand in that. So he's not very young. He's getting higher in his age. He's getting up there. Nevertheless, if he does become a counsel for Donald Trump, and he was one of the early supporters of Donald Trump, and he was actually running for office when Donald Trump was running, then we are looking at a situation where Donald Trump is going to be bolstered. Having said that, most people are afraid of legal lawsuits, especially at the presidential level. Donald Trump is an expert, and he actually goads people into suing him so he can sue them back. So this is a shameless man, and he has shameless people around him, like Rudy Giuliani. Rudy Giuliani, let me just put it, since you asked that question, let me just put it to you very briefly. This guy's only asset was 9/11. That was his political sort of cash cow. And so that's how he really ran the town after he was still the mayor of that town, before Bloomberg got it. He's but on the same token, we have to be fair and balanced. He really was tough on the mafia in New York. He did incredible renovation and closing down the ghettos, improving the ghetto situation in New York. At the same time, at the federal or national level, he's definitely going to be dangerous. He is instrumental in regime change in Iran. He should not be underestimated. And these people get, you know, thousands of dollars for their speaking fees when they come to... By the way, the MKO is based in Paris. Why the Iranians have not negotiated or threatened Paris to expel these people is beyond me. It's absolutely beyond me. They're hosting a group of terrorists, and these are very well-funded. They have very strong lobbies at the EU in Brussels and also in Washington, but they are a proven terrorist group. They were also instrumental, MKO, or they also go by MEK, instrumental in suppressing the Iranian, the Iraqi people, because they decided to side with Iraq during the Iran-Iraq war. They're political opportunists, and they put down the Kurdish rebellion after the 1990 war. They put down the Shia rebellion and after the 1990 war. And they're extremely nasty people.
Now,
and
okay, these sorts of terrorists like MKO, MEK, where do they get their funding from? Who is pulling their strings?
The funding comes from, part of it comes from EU. A big chunk of it comes from Washington. And now, of course, if they're in France, I'm sure the French are supporting them. The French are using them as a leverage to negotiate with the Iranians. And the Iranians, I'm afraid, are falling for it. That should be one of the prerequisites. When Trump was on national air yesterday, or international air, accusing Iran of terrorism, it was, we all know the hypocrisy of Washington, but this was at the disgusting level, because they are supporting the nastiest the terrorists, in this case, MEK or MKO.
Now, give us an example of what have MKO and MEK actually been up to over the years, you know, and how long have they been active in Iran?
They've been acting since the 1960s in Iran. They were instrumental in, you know, overthrowing the Shah. They were actually with the revolution in the beginning, but very rapidly, because they wanted to take power and put their guy in power. His name was Masoud Rajavi. He got actually killed in Iraq. They had a military base in Iraq during Saddam Hussein war. It was called Ashraf military base, not too long from Baghdad. That totally got liquidified. I mean, they destroyed it. Iraq is destroyed. The Iranians destroyed it. A lot of those fighters there are all over Europe, especially in Sweden, Germany, and now France. These people started in the 60s. They started legitimately, even though they call themselves Islamic Marxists. And they fought against the Shah. They killed Americans. That's on record. But you know, shift forward 40, 50 years into the future, their lobby is so strong in Washington that they somehow managed to take themselves out of the terrorist watch list or terrorist group or designated terrorist organization. And they have very strong lobbies in Washington. One of them is called the Iran Project, in which they have very strong influence over neocons like John McCain. He's the senior senator in Arizona. And then Lindsey Graham from North Carolina, these super neocon pro-Israel, pro-Zionist senators, and they're openly in league with the MKO.
What about the immediate problems after the revolution? And you say that MKO, MEK were actually involved at the time of the revolution, because I know that there were thousands of terrorist attacks in Iran. There was also the horrific attack which killed members of the cabinet and the president not long after the revolution. Was MKO and MEK involved in those?
Absolutely. Absolutely, it's proven. I mean, they killed, they were involved in the killing of a prime minister and a president very early in 1982, if I'm correct, at the prime ministerial residence in close to the Iranian, the former Iranian parliament location. They were and involved all the way down to the future. They, by the way, they cooperate very closely with Mossad. Mossad actually does the planning, MKO does the implementation. They were instrumental in murdering Iranian nuclear scientists very, very lately. Also, they were responsible and took credit for taking out Sayyad Shirazi, a high-ranking Iranian general who was also murdered by these people way after the end of Iran-Iraq war. So this is a very, very nasty group who's been active in terrorist operations during the Shah time and after Shah was toppled, when they couldn't get in power, when the Ayatollahs took over and they edged these Islamic Marxists out of power. And they're neither Islamic nor are they Marxist or communist or socialist. They are just a very shrewd, opportunistic group of traitors to their own homeland, which happens to be Iran. Now, a lot of them capitulated after United States attack and occupation, invasion and occupation of Iraq in 2003. Many of the rank and file capitulated to the West. Many of them actually have been repatriated back to Iran. And they're very, very vocal all over YouTube describing how evil this organization was. Masoud Rajavi, who was the head of that organization, was a disgustingly corrupt man, having orgies in pools in the Ashraf military base. This has been well documented. This is a very evil man. His wife, Maryam Rajavi, who runs MKO right now in Paris, was actually ordered, Tony, he was ordered to divorce her husband and marry Rajavi. This is not just a political organization. It's also a very dangerous cult. The West has defined it as a cult, not just a political covert organization. And by the way, they have excellent organizational skills, which made them very, very dangerous. But their power is corroding. Even when they have, you know, morons like John Bolton or Rudy Giuliani at these huge conferences, which is, by the way, you can watch it on the YouTube. They don't have enough people to support them. So they actually bring people from Bulgaria and Eastern Europe. They drive them with buses to Paris in order to make their population look bigger in propaganda videos that they have.
Now, Rudy Giuliani and John Bolton, Martin, these are people who are very close now to Trump, and yet they're going along to these conferences of terrorists, the people who would do everything they can to kill the leaders of Iran.
Well, in actual fact, the thing about MEK, because of the history, they are Islamic Marxists. That's their official ideology. And you feel like saying to John Bolton and Rudy Giuliani, so you support Marxists, do you? Armed Marxists. Islamist Marxists. And, of course, they do, even though they didn't... When they participated in the 1979 revolution, they were regarded as the enemy. But now, of course, they're being used as a cat's paw to try and undermine the current regime.
But the idea is that if these terrorists are wanting to overthrow a regime that we don't like, they're okay. If they're not doing that, then we're going to have to get rid of them.
Well, historically, they actually killed Americans before they became America's ally. A bit like Al Qaeda. They've got to get credibility.
So what's their role?
Pretending to kill the Americans, even though they're funded by the Americans.
As this conflict we're just about to hear the latest on between Iran and Israel starts to develop, I mean, it doesn't really seem like it's. It seems like it's on a ratchet. It's not going to go anywhere but up. What's MEK's role going to be?
Well, they were originally based, as I understand it, in Iraq under Saddam Hussein, but I think the current Iraqi government have kicked them out. So they haven't got a base
anymore. Yeah, but they're in Paris. They're based in Paris. They have rallies in Paris.
But they are the main people who carry out terrorist attacks inside Iran to try and destabilise the country. But in actual fact, their popular support in Iran is minuscule. They haven't got any popular support to speak of. And in actual fact, they're regarded as traitors, as they are.
Aren't they really just kind of special forces for the West?
Well, they've been trained by Western Special Forces.
So what's the difference between this terrorist group and actually being a cadre of the Special Forces?
The word terrorist, I don't care what we call them. We can call them terrorists if we like. They are. What happens in the West is that the sort of Gladio style in which things operate, they fund various kinds of terrorists. They fund Islamist terrorists. They fund Islamic Marxist terrorists. They fund anybody who will actually attack the enemies they want to see attacked. And, of course, I believe you went to a conference about terrorism in Iran some while ago, and they were saying, well, we've had 17,000 civilians killed inside Iran in terrorist attacks. And, of course, they openly boast that they've killed loads of Iranian nuclear scientists. And, of course, the Iranians, you could argue, were within their rights to come and kill British nuclear scientists.
Who's operationally in control of MEK, MKO? It's the Israelis, and yet the funding is coming from the US and NATO.
Yeah, well, don't forget Mossad, CIA, MI6, it's all the same team, really, and the MEK are their little protégés, a bit like the White Helmets.
Anyway, let's go on to this exchange of fire in the Golan Heights and Syria. Martin, what do you make of that this week?
Well, we're being presented with a kind of, you've got to work out what actually happened before you can comment. What seems to have happened Don't forget, the Israelis have been bombing inside Syria for ages. You know, they just fly in from Lebanon, or they do it from Lebanese airspace, and they attack the Syrian army, etc.
It's been happening for several months.
For years, not for several months. I mean, they just keep doing it.
Intensifying it.
Intensifying it. And what actually happened? It wasn't Syrian Arab Army have said it wasn't the Iranians that fired into the Golan Heights. We fired at your stuff in the Golan Heights because we're getting fed up with you thinking that you can just attack us at will and we're not going to retaliate. But
nothing to do with the Americans pulling out of the JCPOA.
No, what we're talking about here is the Israelis have waited for them to pull out of the JCPOA because they want a war with Iran. They're pretty clear about it. And the British government had better make up their mind pretty quick because there's going to be a war with Iran and we're either going to be in it or out of it. And I suggest that most British people don't want to be in it, but we're going to be in it anyway and the Tories are going to drag us in.
Isn't the way of the Western powers often that they egg on other people to get involved in a war but they don't want to suffer themselves?
The Israelis want to start the war, but they want the Americans to finish it, and that presumably includes us. But do we want to go to war with Iran? People listening to this show, are you ready to go to war with Iran now? Do you hate them enough to go to war with them? For, of course, the other thing you've got to say, if you're going to go to war with Iran, what's your strategy? Because, of course, the Gulf is actually a killing field. A killing field. The Royal Navy ships in the Gulf will all be in Davy Jones' locker half an hour after the shooting starts. If we run away to war with Iran, we need to think about that.
And what about oil?
Oil? Well, the Iranians, because of the sanctions on Iran that are coming back in, the oil price is starting to climb, which means, of course, the world economy is being pushed to the brink. But, of course, this is actually good news for Russia and Venezuela. So we'll see how it plays out. They shouldn't really... The problem with them is these people want a war, but they haven't got a strategy for winning it. And if it comes to war, they need to be given a very decisive bloody nose. Very decisive. And then we'll see. But, of course, the world economy will not take the shock. And that could lead... don't forget that if the economy collapses and the West is defeated in war, that's a revolutionary situation. The population won't stand for it.
Anyway, let's
have a listen. The population of the US, never mind the population of Britain.
Let's have a listen now to the spokesman for the Likud party and Netanyahu's office, the Israeli Prime Minister, David Keyes, now speaking on Channel 4 News with Jon Snow last night.
Well, it depends what Iran does going forward. It's now tried to move its forces about 1,000 miles west, right to Israel's border. In the early mornings, in the early hours of this morning, it shot dozens of missiles into Israel. We responded in kind. We hope the situation doesn't escalate. But Iran, for some time now, has been undertaking outrageous and aggressive provocations against Israel, lobbing missiles into Israel, supporting terrorist organizations that call for our annihilation, and, of course, speaking very openly about the fact that they seek nothing less than the destruction of Israel. We will not let that happen, which is precisely why we responded.
This missile attack, you say, that has occurred on Israel, where were the targets and what damage has been sustained?
Well, they lobbed 20 missiles towards Israel. Four of them were shot down by our defensive mechanisms, and the rest of them landed actually inside of Syrian territory.
But the response that you've meted out appears to be somewhat larger than the four missiles that you shot down and the other ones which landed in Syria anyway.
Well, Iran's aims are a lot bigger than four missiles as well. They've sent an awful lot of forces right to our border. They've tried to send advanced weaponry through Syria right to Israel's border. And they consistently call for our annihilation.
Right, let's just unpick this a little bit. The Iranian forces in Syria are largely there to support the Syrian government against the Al-Qaeda rebels supported by the West and Israel. The Israelis, there was a very interesting development this week. Hezbollah and its allies won the election in Lebanon. And, of course, they are the democratically elected government of Lebanon. The Israelis claim their right to self-defence, but they won't negotiate with the Palestinians about anything. Now, the state of Israel is not necessarily a state that should be recognised by the United Nations. It was created in 1948 and it was given certain borders. They've never agreed to those borders. They've got an expansionist agenda. The Golan Heights actually belongs to Syria. So when they say we're being threatened and so on,
well, Martin, what he said there was that the Iranians, and we're not sure if it was the Iranians, but anyway, they fired missiles towards Israel. So he's not actually saying that they were fired at Israel. Even he admits
they were actually fired at the Golan, Israeli positions in the Golan Heights. Yeah.
So they were fired towards
and they were fired by the Syrian Arab Army. The Syrian Arab Army said, "No, we fired those missiles because we're sick of you bombing us." Now, if we're going to have a war, the question of whether the state of Israel should be allowed to exist in the borders which it claims, including the Golan Heights, etc., and of course Gaza, is that border between Gaza and Israel isn't an international border. Those people inside Gaza used to live on the other side of the border in land which is now populated by Israeli settlers. Now, ultimately, if you're going to have a world war, then at the end of that world war, you might lose. And that's why people should think twice before they start it. And in actual fact, if it does come to a full-on fight between the Iranians and everybody else, the West and the Israelis, it's not clear that the West and Israel are going to win. If they want to have the war, they can have it, but they're not necessarily going to win. Now, the geography is all against them.
Now, next week,
not to mention the morality.
Between 6 and 8 p.m., we'll be having a special on the 9/11 attacks with an expert from the United States, Richard Gage, who runs something called, and founded something called Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, also the author. We had here actually last September, Ian Henshaw. We'll be taking things on a bit and looking much more at the most important evidence that 9/11 wasn't necessarily the attack that we were told at the time, and that the inquiry was effectively a cover-up. Of course, Martin, this was an excuse for the war on terror, wasn't it?
Indeed. And underlying all of this, at the end of the world war we're probably going to have to endure now, let's hope that serious historians will write serious history.
Well,
it's pretty obvious that that was an inside job carried out by the US security forces, helped by Mossad. And that's what the historians will write.
Now, one of the interesting aspects of this is that Bush and Blair were prosecuted in Malaysia and found guilty, weren't they? And I think it was Benjamin Netanyahu and Zippy Livni. So there are various people involved in war crimes that were a result of this war on terror. And Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad has scored a historic victory just 2 days ago in the Malaysian general election. So he's back. The guy that did these prosecutions over in Malaysia is back in power.
Yeah, and the Malaysians also brought in exchange controls in the 1998 crisis, which the IMF told them not to do. So in many ways, the Malaysians are, they are regarded as a problem by the Western
powers.
They're
very close to the Singapore government, which is a sort of authoritarian socialist government, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there's a bit of tension there because the Malay nationalists and the Singaporean Chinese didn't necessarily get on. But at the same time, they represent an alternative pole of power. And I think it's very interesting that Mahathir Mohamad has come. He's going to release Anwar Ibrahim, who was his original protege and was regarded by the West as somebody to replace Mohamad with. And he's been in prison, but what he said is, "I'm going to release him." I think that he's also been very sceptical of the 9/11 story. Of all the world
which
leaders.
He's
just won an overwhelming victory in his own country.
We'll be discussing that next week. But now, back home to talk to Mark Watts, who's the investigative journalist who arguably broke the stories that led to the setting up of the National Inquiry into Institutionalised and Westminster Child Sexual Abuse, the so-called VIP Defile Inquiry.
My name is Mark Watts. I'm a freelance investigative journalist, former editor of Exero, which did a lot of pioneering work in the whole field of child sexual abuse reporting, for example, really sparked the overarching inquiry into child sexual abuse. At least that's what it initially was. It's become a little bit less overarching as time has gone on. And I'm still spending, I suppose, the majority of my time working in the field, mainly because so many people are coming forward to me, both in terms of abuse survivors who want to tell their stories, particularly when it relates to VIPs, but also whistleblowers, I suppose, especially former police officers.
Now, it's quite feasible that people might be coming to you, Mark, who are actually not been abused at all or know nothing about it, just simply to muddy the waters. Have you found that at all? And how do you tell the difference?
I think there are people out there who are certainly trying to do that, but I don't think they're really abuse survivors. I think that, for example, there are certain people within the police and in other agencies who are out there trying to muddy the waters and probably have succeeded in doing so.
Now, can you give us any examples of that? Because, I mean, if the police are doing that sort of thing, that's pretty serious. Can you give us any examples of police that have done that?
There's a long history of that. I mean, there's a long history of dodgy police sources and sources, you know, in other in government departments who do exactly that. And I think one of the problems is that a lot of journalists rely on a single source, and especially if they have a source who on face value appears to be a very good source, they just run with what that apparently very good source has told them, regardless of whether there's any likelihood of any truth to it. And I mean, I think there is a problem here. I mean, I think as a journalist, I've often come across journalists who come to me, as it were, and pitch stories which are relying on a single source.
Exaro News was doing an incredible job a couple of years ago in really pushing this into the public domain in various ways. What's happened to Exaro?
Well, Exaro fell victim to a financial problem at the group that owned it called New Sparta. There was a financial crisis that had nothing to do with Exaro, except that the consequences of it had a lot to do with Exaro. So there was a sort of black hole that opened up in New Sparta Group. The group had to carry out an emergency review of all its various companies. And obviously Exaro at the time was not making a profit. It was making a loss in the order of a few £100,000 a year. And so in the context of the group wanting to stem the kind of hemorrhaging of any cash, obviously a company that was making that kind of loss was very vulnerable to being closed, and so they set about closing it for that reason.
Now, the whole business of child sex abuse has been covered by most of the major newspapers. There certainly appears to be plenty of column inches there. How easy is it to actually make money investigating child sexual abuse? I mean, is it financially viable, effectively, is what I'm saying?
I think if you're a freelance investigative journalist, it's quite difficult to make investigative journalism pay on any subject. I think probably what your question, focusing specifically on the issue of child sexual abuse, it is especially difficult now because of the sort of backlash there's been on the subject in the last sort of couple of years. I mean, when Exaro was running, we often worked with mainstream media outlets, and we worked with them on a whole array of stories, whether it be when we got hold of the secret Murdoch recording, when we found out about, you know, senior civil servants minimizing their tax by working off payroll. Often when we did these big stories that had a big impact, we would work with news television programs or with national newspapers. And the consistent thing with this is that the revenue we derived from those outlets would never cover the cost of carrying out the investigation concerned. So I suppose the direct answer to your question is that it's not profitable at all. And indeed, when we set up Exaro, we didn't even have, in the original business plan, the prospect of making revenue from editorial sales, if you like. Even in there was other lines of revenue which were down to the commercial side of the operation, none of which basically happened. But the editorial side was very successful, and as a consequence actually did make revenue which hadn't been particularly anticipated, although it came nowhere near covering the costs of the operation. So I think you probably would be aware that you know, investigative journalism is not a particularly well-paid thing. I mean, for someone who has the skills to be a successful investigative journalist, there are a lot more there's a lot more demand, if you like, for those people's services from outside the field of journalism than from within it.
You almost seem to be hinting there that the people who are trying to cover things up pay better than those that are publishing.
I wasn't meaning to hint that. Although, now you've said it, you're probably right. But what I was more thinking is, for example, I have a lot of friends who are investigative journalists who aren't really any longer investigative journalists and who work in, say, corporate investigations. So I don't do that myself, but I am commissioned from time to time to do investigative research projects for all sorts of things, which but for non-journalistic parties, if you like. I mean, yeah. I find myself, you know, doing a trawl at the National Archives on a specific subject, which no newspaper would pay for, because there isn't really the resource there for that kind of work. But there are plenty of other people who might commission you to do that work because they need it for a court case or whatever it may be.
Now, one of the problems is libel. If you say something about somebody, and I believe Harvey Proctor has just taken out a case against the Metropolitan Police because just simply for telling the public through the press that he was being investigated. Can you just take us briefly through some of the minefield of what the libel laws mean for someone who's trying to investigate a criminal who's actually prepared to sue just simply for mentioning their name?
As I understand it, his claim, which has only just been filed at the High Court against the Met, and indeed against the person who made the complaint that sparked the investigation, a person known by the pseudonym of Nick, I think it's a slightly broader claim for damages than simply defamation, although I do think defamation is part of it, but I think it's broader. And it's an interesting one because it's almost as if he seems to be saying that the police shouldn't have investigated him, had no business investigating him. There's another case that's a little bit more advanced, and I think everyone is watching with great interest in this field, which is Cliff Richard, who's obviously suing the BBC. And it's not a defamation action, actually, although, of course, defamation is part of his allegations against the BBC. The action is essentially a claim that they breached his privacy. Is kind of brought under data protection laws, and he's seeking very significant damages running into many hundreds of thousands of pounds, which is interesting because a libel case probably wouldn't generate that much by way of damages these days. It's pretty hard, I think, to win more than a couple of hundred thousand pounds, probably even a lot less than that. And fundamentally, he's saying that the BBC acted outrageously and breached his privacy and reduced his reputation by reporting the fact that a raid had been carried out on his property, even though the investigation subsequently didn't result in any charges or even in any arrest. Now, the BBC is saying, well, we have a right to report that this has happened. Nothing we reported breached the presumption of innocence. Now, we'll have to see what the decision in this case is. And I have already publicly predicted that whoever loses will, I think, appeal. So we'll have to wait for the outcome of the Court of Appeal decision, and who knows, it may go higher than that. But I think the real issues in the case come down to, is it a matter of public interest that the police are investigating a particular person, that they might have arrested someone? They didn't in this case. They didn't in the case of Harvey Proctor. But actually, Cliff Richard and in the case of Harvey Proctor, they did raid their properties. So does the media have a right to report such things? You know, should Britain become even more secretive than it already is and stop such reporting? But the other issue that will come into play with the Cliff Richard case is maybe it's not just a question of whether you can or can't report, but exactly how you do it. In other words, was it really appropriate to send up a helicopter and shoot through Cliff Richard's windows? Maybe the court will decide that that amounted to overkill. Even though the BBC, of course, resolutely says they feel it was entirely appropriate. In a way, at X-Ray, we were in a similar position because, of course, we made the decision to report on the fact that Harvey Proctor's house had been raided. And, of course, it's fairly common practice for newspapers to report on arrests or property raids. It may be that the investigation goes no further. Harvey Proctor's property was raided, he was interviewed under caution, but he wasn't arrested, and nothing was sent to the CPS for a charging decision.
Now, one person we can talk about until the cows come home is Gordon Anglesey, who is this senior policeman in North Wales. Can you just tell us about that case? Because I think it's pretty shocking that somebody can successfully shut down any press reporting on them and then afterwards be convicted as an abuser.
I think it's a really illuminating case. Back in 1994, as you say, he successfully sued for libel. The Independent Sunday, The Observer, HTV, and even Private Eye. He won £375,000 because of reports that imply that he was a paedophile. various witnesses who claim to have been sexually abused by him gave their evidence in court, and he won the case, which is, of course, only on the balance of probabilities, not beyond reasonable doubt, as it would be in a criminal case. It's only on the balance of probabilities. But even on the balance of probabilities, the media companies in that case could not establish the truth of the allegation. Now, shortly after that case, one of those witnesses was so traumatized by the fact that he had been attacked by Anglesey's lawyers in court and dismissed as a liar who was simply telling a story just for money, for, you know, for compensation or for some sort of monetary reward. He actually took his own life because he could not stand the fact that he'd been disbelieved. Now, fast forward many years, that was all back in 94, fast forward to November 2016, and that Gordon Anglesey, by now a former superintendent of North Wales Police, is being jailed for 12 years for having sexually abused two boys aged around 14 and 15. It was four charges in all of indecent assault against these two boys. So it turned out all those many years later that a criminal court deciding beyond reasonable doubt that Anglesey was, as those media companies had said all along back many years previous, was indeed a paedophile. And how dreadful to think about those witnesses who so bravely tried to tell their story back then, and one of them ended up hanging himself as a consequence of not being believed at the time. Now, Anglesey was jailed for 12 years, and just 6 weeks into his sentence, he died in prison, well, actually in hospital. He had multiple organ failure, we learned from an inquest just recently. He was 79, so he was quite old, but he got well and truly found out in the end.
Now, there's a national inquiry going on. Really, a lot of this is into child sexual abuse. This is mostly being caused, really, by the exposure of Jimmy Savile, who had some very, very powerful contacts right at the very top of the British establishment. That national inquiry has had several chairs. The latest is Alexis Jay. The one before her was from New Zealand, but with very mysterious circumstances, without her really giving any explanation, she decided she didn't want to chair the inquiry and went back to New Zealand. I just wondered if you can give us some insight into why she left, and also how well is Alexis Jay doing in the National Inquiry, Mark?
Well, I think Lowell Goddard was having some problems in so far as she felt as though the Home Office really was controlling what she could do to great an extent, which is a fundamental problem of this inquiry, which I don't think it will ever shake itself free from. And so much so that she was under the impression that she couldn't even appoint staff who she wanted to, and was obliged to have the sort of seconded Home Office civil servants who largely staff the inquiry.
Now, hang on, because that's a major problem, isn't it? Because you've got the Home Office actually being accused of being part of the conspiracy to cover up child sexual abuse.
Well, indeed. The original intention was that the inquiry would be overarching. It was ordered by Theresa May as Home Secretary in 2016, some years after Savile was exposed, and it was really as a result of actually reporting by Exero, and then a campaign by a group of cross-party group of MPs to get the inquiry instituted. And the original idea was that it would be overarching across the UK. And bit by bit, the people who were involved in the inquiry, the secretariat, the Home Office civil servants who've been seconded, together with the lawyers, kind of ensured that that overarching inquiry was curtailed. So I suppose the first thing was much of the UK was cut away from it. So Northern Ireland, which is in fact a very important part of the picture, was cut away. Scotland was cut away. The Channel Islands were cut away. So you were left with England and Wales. And I think the inquiry is going to do some useful work tackling child sexual abuse. There has been an interim report published in the past few weeks, which in my view made some very useful recommendations. But the thing that really sparked the inquiry was the prevalence of paedophiles operating in Westminster. And this is indeed one of the strands of the inquiry. Now, I think in this field, which is obviously peculiarly sensitive, there are all sorts of very powerful interest groups that do not want this to be fully or even slightly exposed. And I think the inquiry has shown itself to have been hugely constrained on this side of things. There was a preliminary hearing for the Westminster investigation back in January. And counsel to the inquiry, at least for this investigation, kind of set out what the scope of the Westminster investigation would be. And it does seem as though counsel is really running the inquiry rather than the panel, and there seems to be a problem with its constitution. I think the lawyers forget that they're there to advise. They kind of end up seeming to behave as if they're there running the show, and it looks like, in practice, that's exactly what they're doing. And the scope that was recommended by the lawyers for the Westminster investigation is hugely constrained. I have no doubt that when the panel announces its decision on the scope, which it will do in the next few weeks, I understand, I have no doubt that it will go along with what counsel said, namely to keep it highly limited. So I think the inquiry will do useful work on the subject, but I have my doubts as to whether it will really uncover anything in relation to Westminster. And if you take the example of Cyril Smith, it's already reached some conclusions in the Rochdale investigation, and it basically said in relation to Cyril Smith that the prosecutors missed opportunities to prosecute him. Well, that wasn't telling us anything we didn't already know. A senior CPS figure had years ago already put CPS's hands up, as it were, to having failed to prosecute Cyril Smith on three separate occasions when it should have done so. So the inquiry and its conclusions didn't add much to the picture there.
I think one of the biggest problems with child sexual abuse, I don't know if you agree, is this whole thing of a kind of double trauma. So when people are abused, obviously that is a trauma, but then when they try and get it dealt with through the police and through the courts, that can turn into another trauma, not just, you know, having to relive the experience, retell the experience, but then finding that the relationship with the police or whoever it is can actually become abusive and, you know, really difficult for them. And they are then left thinking, well, maybe I should never have gone to the police in the first place. So I wonder what you make of that. I mean, you mentioned the whole business with Gordon Anglesey and people who had tried to get him prosecuted, one of whom then killed themselves after what sounds like a miscarriage of justice. The same sort of thing happened with the Jimmy Savile case, where these various victims of Savile were interviewed by Liz McKean at Newsnight, and then she had to call them to say, well, I'm very sorry that even though I've interviewed you and you've had to go through that, I've been told by my editor that we can't run this story. So they would have been extremely upset that they've gone through this all apparently for nothing. So I wonder if we're getting anywhere with making sure that those who do decide that they're going to tell all about a horrific experience as a young person are actually well treated rather than abused again.
I think your point that abuse survivors often find themselves being re-traumatized by the failure of other institutions to investigate their allegations properly is absolutely correct. And just on Gordon Anglesey, one of the ironies was, I mean, I mentioned he was of North Wales Police, but one of the great ironies was that it was North Wales Police that were actually very keen before the case in 2016, were actually very keen to prosecute him. They investigated him and they wanted him prosecuted. But the Crown Prosecution Service, that institution that time and time again has made mistakes in failing to prosecute people. I mentioned Cyril Smith. He's held his hand up to three failures on that one. Greville Janner, as he then was, later Lord Janner, a former Labour MP, the CPS held his hands up to failing to prosecute him on three separate occasions as well. And when it came to Gordon Anglesey, the CPS also refused to prosecute him previously, even though North Wales Police had investigated him and wanted him prosecuted, felt that the case was there. Of course, they eventually did prosecute him, and it was ultimately successful. So I think the CPS is a very important institution in failing abuse survivors. Certainly that's true in the past, and I think it's going on right now. The police, I think, is a mixed picture. I think it's really mixed. Clearly, there are examples of what you're talking about, where the police have behaved very poorly in investigating allegations and have effectively re-traumatised abuse survivors. But on the other hand, I do know of instances where that
that the opposite is the case. There were police officers who've done a terrific job in trying or in successfully investigating such cases. But you know what? I think the inquiry has to watch its behaviour, because I think the inquiry is falling into the same trap. And I wouldn't be surprised, quite frankly, if in a few decades' time we have another inquiry which will have as part of its scope how this inquiry has treated abuse survivors so appallingly and effectively re-traumatised them.
Well, meanwhile, of course, many of the abusers have lived out their old age happily and have died without actually being prosecuted. But anyway, what advice have you got now for anybody who either themselves or they know someone, friends or family, who have been abused, Mark?
Well, it's an interesting one because, I mean, it does depend on the precise circumstances. I think generally, you know, I do encourage people to go to the police, although with great care, but I do encourage people to do that. I do encourage people to engage with the inquiry despite its obvious failings in public and some privately as well. So I encourage people to engage. I suppose what happened in practice with me is often it's people who are making allegations against prominent people where the police do not want to tackle it, or where other institutions have failed those people. Those are the people who tend to, as it were, come forward to me because they want something done about it. And quite often what I find is almost kind of doing a bit of personal advocacy, i.e. pointing to where they might go, where they might try to progress their cases. So I suppose the overall message I would have to people in that situation is to keep fighting.
What about Freemasonry? Do you think that's and it has played any role?
Well, I think in terms of what I've found is I think it would be correct to say it has a role. So sometimes it plays a part in perhaps the abuse. But it also plays a part in literally squaring away the police. So it can be a rather useful instrument for a paedophile to ensure that they can get away with it if, for example, they or someone they're closely linked to is in the same lodge as a police officer who's in a position to pull some strings. So I think that kind of thing has happened. Witnesses who've come forward, and indeed police officers who have talked to me about investigations that were closed down, I think what the evidence from those people suggests is where it really comes into play is in literally squaring away investigations. So if an investigation needs to be closed down, it's one route, not the only route, but one route of achieving that end. Person A can simply ring up person B and say, can you do us a favour and just drop that case?
What about following what's been happening with the National Inquiry? Have you got any tips for places to keep an eye on this?
It's tricky at the moment because, you know, I don't think people can really believe a word of what they're reading in the newspapers about what's going on this issue, quite frankly. I tend to be following it quite closely, so people should certainly follow my Twitter feed, which will probably have a lot of key developments as and when they occur. But quite frankly, if people are interested in the subject, they're better off actually reading the transcripts of hearings of those investigations that they're particularly interested in. They're all available on the Inquiry's website. As an example of that, when the Cyril Smith hearings happened, the reporting of it was incredibly poor. There was quite a lot of interesting stuff that surfaced in the evidence, even if there wasn't much interesting in the final report. And it caused me to actually do a roundup of all the interesting evidence that had surfaced in the inquiry, which the media had pretty much managed to not notice. Those kind of articles I do publish on the FOIA Centre website. So I run something called the FOIA Centre, which is a specialist research company. FOIA stands for Freedom of Information Act. So we can go to foiacentre.com and look at the news section there. www.foiacentre.com. And I'm on Twitter at markwatts_1.
Mark Watts, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Martin, some fascinating insight there, I think, and also particularly this idea of the new data laws allowing people like Harvey Proctor and Cliff Richard to sue the police and the press for invasions of privacy. Now, these are the sorts of private prosecutions that are actually only really open to rich people.
Indeed. I mean, if it was the case that everybody who is accused of a crime, it couldn't be reported until they've been convicted, then you could say that that's one set of rules. But that's never been the case in this country. People accused of crimes are, it's reported that they've been accused of crimes. If they're poor people, they don't get any.
Yeah, there
buy.
Are rules for balance reporting if someone is being.
That's right. You've got to say alleged and accused.
If
so on.
If someone is arrested, that's fine. You can report that. If they're charged, then there's rules come in. But what they're suggesting here is that Cliff Richard and Harvey Proctor shouldn't have been reported on. Anyway, we're also. Part of this seems to be that the. Failure of legal aid as well, because there's a lawyer's strike going on. Apparently it's hit courts in Swindon this week. Mm. You might not care, says Gabby Hinscliffe in The Guardian, about striking lawyers, but you should, she says. We're already seeing the dreadful effects of legal underfunding as people are forced to defend themselves with only the vaguest idea of what they're doing. So at least lawyers are saying, well, actually, we want to represent people. We're not being allowed to.
Well, indeed, what will eventually happen, it's already happening, and it's in many ways it's been going on for a long time, is that poor people simply won't be properly defended. And therefore, they're more likely to be convicted and so on and so forth.
OK, finally, the undercover police inquiry. I mean, this is another inquiry. We just heard about what a disaster this national inquiry into child sexual abuse has turned into. The undercover policing inquiry. Apparently, the report is now going to take at least 8 years, and that the judge in charge of the inquiry has been speaking to an empty court because the participants have boycotted it because they won't give them the names of the police involved.
Well, indeed. I mean, exactly. So these people, these police officers are being protected even though they carried out illegal acts. And that's not good enough, is it?
OK, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8. Thanks to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Our sister show Dialects on Tuesday at noon on dialectradio.co.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. You can comment at thisweek.org.uk. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we'll hear a talk given by my former co-host, Dr. Peter Phillips. Many of you know, not only was Peter director of Project Censored and did 14 books with us at Censored, he also has been working on a new book called Giants, The Global Power Elite. It's a look at the top 200 most powerful players in world capitalism who are at the controls of our economic future. We'll hear a talk that Peter gave for Sonoma State University's 4th Annual Social Justice Week about giants, the global power elite. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Who holds the purse strings to the majority of the world's wealth? There's a new global elite at the controls of our economic future. And here, Peter Phillips unveils for the general reader just who these players are. Peter Phillips, for the last several years, has been working on a new book, Giants, the Global Power Elite. In his new book, Peter will unveil the work that he's been doing, not only for the last several years, but really a culmination of the work he's done in political sociology for decades. For the 4th Annual Sonoma State University Social Justice Week, Peter gave a talk called Giants, the Global Power Elite. It's a fantastic outline and teaser for his forthcoming book. Here's Peter Phillips, Giants, the Global Power Elite.
Good afternoon. I'm Peter Phillips from the sociology department here at Sonoma State. And I'm going to talk about the global power elite, the giants of capitalism. And there's a picture that you all have a copy of. And this is the Diego Rivera mural, which now resides in Mexico City. But this is the second copy of it. This mural was was first done at the Rockefeller Center in 1934 by Diego Rivera. And Rockefeller didn't like it, but he had certain figures in there and destroyed the entire mural.
That sounds
the mural is, it's called the Man of the Universe, and it seemed appropriate that, one, the Rockefellers had destroyed it, and two, that it's about a very powerful person. And so that's going to be on the picture of my Global Power Elite book from Seven Stories Press. Part of the conversation today, too, is about the transnational capitalist class. Estimates are that the world's wealth is about $255 trillion. And with U.S. and Europe holding about two-thirds of that total. Meanwhile, 80% of the people in the world live on less than $10 a day. And the poorest half of the population lives on $2.50 a day. And 1.3 billion people live on $1.25 a day. So there's massive inequality, and 80% of the world is very poor. The LA Times reports this year that one out of nine people go to bed hungry every night. That's 795 million people on the planet who suffer from chronic hunger, and they're forecasting that 2 billion people will be lacking food by 2050. In addition, one out of three people suffer from some form of malnutrition, which means they lack sufficient vitamins and minerals in their diet that lead to health issues such as stunted growth in children. Each year, poor nutrition kills 3.1 million children under the age of five.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips, and today I'm joined by Toby Blomé and Elder Levine of Code Pink. Our topic will be drone warfare. We'll be hearing audio clips from some documentary, National Bird. This film looks at the mental toil of the drone program, takes on young Americans who fly these remote-controlled aircraft or are involved in the program. It's a dirty game, ain't take my ring for capital gain. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cars that turn to global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips, and joining me in studio today is Toby Blomé and Eleanor Levine of Code Pink. Welcome, Toby. Welcome, Eleanor.
Thank you for having us, Peter.
For the next hour, we'll be telling you about your work opposing drone warfare, and we'll also listen to audio tapes and documentary film National Bird. National Bird presents interviews with three former people involved as researchers in the drone program who describe their jobs and the effect that the work had on their lives. In the film, they identify by their first names only. And so also both Toby and Eleanor were involved in protests down there in Nevada. Can you tell us why and what happened there?
Sure, Peter. Creature Force Base is just north of Las Vegas. It can be thought of as the heart of the U.S. drone assassination program. It's where a lot of the assassination is taking place around the globe, including the assassination orchestrated by the CIA. And so we went down to Crete for our third annual big gathering. People came from all of the United States. There were at least 10 different states covered, including as far away as Wyoming and Wisconsin and Illinois. And we were there for a whole week of peace encampment. And this is an ongoing struggle that we've been doing since 2009, resisting drone assassination. And it was a huge success, measured in many different ways. In particular, we had a big day of mass action, trying to interrupt business as usual on the base, and it was very successful. In the entrance to the where most of the traffic goes in, we had a big, very powerful action of some brave activists standing in the roadway blocking the airmen as they went into the base. They held tombstones, symbolic tombstones of the children who've been killed by U.S. drones with their ages. And one by one, they were carted off by Las Vegas police to vehicles and taken down to the Las Vegas jail. That was one effort of interrupting business as usual on the base. But we also had a small group that were down the highway about 10 miles from the base that did something that was kind of in uncharted territory. We did something new this year. We actually decided to block the highway, a small group of us, because at least 75% of the traffic goes into Creech Air Force Base. And we successfully held the traffic back for an extended amount of time. We slowed it down first and then brought big banners, shut down Creech, and another large, very huge banner that said, drone pilots, please refuse to fly. And it's going to be a big unknown what happens to the... Ultimately, we repeated that similar action the next morning to the surprise of the Las Vegas police even further down the highway. And there are ultimately three of us that were arrested and seven arrested on Wednesday morning at the main gate. And we are continuing our persistence. And there are many other things that happened that week. I'm hoping Eleanor will talk about some of them.
Eleanor, add in a little bit what happened.
We also had two showings of the film National Bird, which Pete has referred to and is from which she's going to play some clips. And in addition, we had a demonstration or protest in front of Trump International Hotel, which is just off the Strip in Las Vegas. And the reason we had the protest there wasn't so much to protest Trump, but because the hotel represents the belly of the beast, that the hotel represents or is emblematic of the concentration of wealth in this country and the concentration of power that's increasing, and which marks the divide between the very wealthy and the increasing number of people who have very little in our country. It was very successful. A lot of people stopped by to talk to us, and a lot of the media came by to talk to us. And so it was a successful event.
That sounds really important, this film, National Bird, at what you're going to be playing clips of today. And we're in Fun Drive. So I want to point that out right now to everybody. And we're very excited because we had a North Bay person contribute a match of $500 to kick us off for today. So, David in Santa Rosa, thank you very much. The DDD National Bird is an hour and a half long program. It's the most terrifying quiet moments, of what's going on is this deep, multi-layered look at America's drone wars. And a strategy, how that's become part of a global strategy since 9/11, and the numbers of innocent victims that are impacted, and we will hear from three of the whistleblowers that were part of that drone program, telling us what's really going on. We also have the Assassination Complex, which is Jeremy Scahill's book on the drone program and the deliberate assassination of people around the world, including American citizens. So the DVD is a $110 pledge. The book is a $90 pledge, both for $180. And so if you're available to call us right now at 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, we're going to play a clip from this film, and we hope that you will call us and kick us off right now. Let's start early in our program. Let's get this match out of the way. Every dollar you give will be a dollar, $2 to the station, and we'd like you to do that. So you're going to hear the voice of Heather. She's the first of three operators and researchers with the drone program, and we meet in National Bird, telling us what she did in the drone warfare program and how that work has changed her life.
You were omniscient in people's lives, and you literally just kind of hover over their area. Sometimes you would watch them for days, and then you'd have intel that this guy is a bad guy, and you wait till he walks out to the field to meet with some friends for something, and you'd blow him up. Drop a hellfire missile on. I originally was interested in the Navy at first because the guy that I was dating had been in the Navy, and I was like, oh, maybe I'll just join the Navy and, you know, travel and see the world and fight for my country and protect people from terrorists. And I ended up being recruited into the Air Force because I actually saw the posters with the drones, and I was like, wow, that is so cool, like unmanned aircraft, like that's really badass. And I was still like under the impression that America was saving the world, like that we were big brother and we were helping everyone out. So when I saw this possibility that I could get out of like the small town that I was in and get out of Pennsylvania and just travel, and I thought that was the only way to do it. like slow motion. And it was like you're watching someone just drag themselves across the field. When you watch someone in those dying moments, what their reaction is, how they're reacting and what they're doing, it's so primitive. It's really raw, stripped down death. That's what it is. This is real. Like, this isn't, it's not a joke. I have specific memories of many of them that I know I killed, but it's so messy and like they don't report it down to us who we killed. Maybe we killed our objective, maybe we killed a guy who we thought was our objective. We don't know. And I can say the drone program's wrong because I don't know how many people I've killed. After we would do a strike, I would ask for a break and like go outside and smoke a cigarette and just think and like try to decompress and just try to push the like idea that I was involved in killing people out of my mind and like try not to think about it. Sometimes if I couldn't really get out of the situation for very long, I would just go to the bathroom and just sit on the toilet, like just sit there in my uniform and just like cry and just think about like what I was doing. It was just different emotional responses. I mean, a lot of times afterwards I would feel just empty, and if I was crying it was because I just didn't know how to stop feeling like that, how to stop feeling like a shell. And it was an empty void. And it was like always shaking after we would do strikes because it's such an adrenaline rush. You're killing someone. You see someone die because you said it was okay to kill them. I was an imagery analyst and a screener. My job was to watch what's happening in the video, the drones, the live video, of course, and identify everything. Another remote duty station, you'd have the pilot, of course, who's flying the actual aircraft, and the sensor operator who is moving the camera around. They were the ones that actually pushed the button. I do not push the button. I just identify what necessitates a button pushing. The bomb hit, and wait for it to cool down a little bit, and then you can see, like, the body parts. You can identify, like, that could be the lower half of his body, that could be a leg, and that sometimes you'll stick around and watch family come and get them, or like pick up the parts and put their family member in a blanket, and a couple people hold onto a corner of the blanket and carry them back to their compound. According to my mental health records, I was high risk for suicide because of the way I acted about my job. My psychologist called my first sergeant, and he recommended that I be possibly moved to anything that wasn't involving watching people die all the time. And the first sergeant said that our team was undermanned and that they absolutely needed me to work mission, so he would look into it, but never returned my psychologist's phone calls, never gave him any indications that I was going to be moved to a better job, and I obviously wasn't. I stayed doing that job until the last possible moment when they had to let me out process because I was actually getting out of the military. So I guess that's the cost of a human life, because the fact that I was on a suicide watch list and they still wouldn't allow me to do something else that might help me a little bit obviously didn't matter to the military, and that shows how much the Air Force cares about its intelligence troops.
That was the voice of Heather from the film National Bird. And she was a drone operator. It's a small unmanned aircraft flown by remote control. It's slow, it's light, it can stay airborne for many hours. Its video cameras keep watch over vast areas. Using satellite communications, drones fly over Afghanistan and are controlled from military bases in the U.S., often through Germany, and they're equipped with surveillance gear and many carry missiles. The National Bird interviews with Afghans or talks about family losses and people that are involved. And here we hear one of the people, Heather, who was involved in that and realizing that she was killing people. So one of the surprising things we find about National Bird in this film is these drone operators and researchers there, observers, are not necessarily career military people. They're young recruits, and they have one of their options in their life. I mean, they're what do you think about that? With me in studio is Toby Blomé and Eleanor Levine. What do you think about these youthful people and the impact it's having on their lives?
I think, for me personally, it's a sign of how little the people in charge in the military value the human beings that are fighting these wars, and especially that they would put someone who is so young, some of them are just barely 18 or 19, in a position like that, doing things they haven't even evolved, fully matured as adults yet, and they're asked to do very criminal acts against their own upbringing by their parents, you know, respecting life, and they're brainwashed to believe that they're doing it for good reasons at first, but over time it takes a huge toll on them, and many of them are so injured psychically, it will take many, many years to heal from, if they ever are able to fully heal, and they're victims of this whole program and U.S. foreign policy. They're as much victims as the people who are sitting ducks on the ground that we're assassinating.
It saddened me. I'd like to add something. This is Eleanor. I'd like to add something. When we were at Creech just a month ago or a few weeks ago, there was a group of young people who came from some kind of Christian academy who stood across the highway from us, lining the road that enters the base at Creech Air Force Base, and they were shouting and waving signs saying, "Support our troops, we support our troops." But in fact, the best way for us to support our troops is to get the truth out, and for people to see films like National Bird, hear Heather speak, hear the other two drone analysts and operators speak, and to really understand that supporting our troops means not putting them in harm's way, bringing the troops home, and explaining to the American public what the real cost, the psychological cost, not just the financial cost, of putting young people in the position of being killers before they're even allowed to drink legally. That just makes no sense.
And another conundrum of these young operators is that they're high security clearance. And so if they're having psychological problems, they can't go to a therapist unless a therapist has a security clearance as well. So that's quite troubling. And it doesn't seem to be offered very much in terms of what the military provides. Have you met some of these people? Toby Blum?
We have met several of them. One, Lisa Ling, lives in the Bay Area. We've had multiple conversations with her. A couple of the whistleblowers, not in this film, but have been in many other drone films, have actually joined us. Vets for Peace sponsored them to come down to Las Vegas and speak after the film showing of National Bird. And we got to hear their personal stories. And then they're so courageous to actually speak out. And it was really evident in the film, Daniel, one of the whistleblowers in the film, is represented. You can tell he's so traumatized. He wants to just be able to talk openly about what he was involved in, and because he's tied down to the agreements to keep the confidential military secrets away from the public, he's really conflicted inside, and that's another trauma that these even the whistleblowers that came to Las Vegas, you can tell there's only so much that they are able to talk about, or they'll find themselves in jail very rapidly.
It's somewhat diabolical, and that's what I get from reading Assassination Complex by Jeremy Scahill. This is the inside the government secret drone warfare program. They don't want us to know the extensiveness of this, how many, literally thousands of people around the world are dying daily the targeting practices, how the White House will say, okay, there's a chain of command, and the military will make a recommendation, and they'll look for targets. And one of these operators was saying that she got a letter that said she had successfully identified 100,000 targets over a couple of years. And, I mean, so we're talking this massive assassination program. I don't think there's any other way to call it that. And that's assassination of people around the world who may or may not threaten the United States in any way. And I can't say anything else except the word diabolical. And it's our nation doing that. And young people being ripped into that and then recognizing the severity of what they're doing. So it's appalling to me. The more I've read about this and the more I've looked at it and thought about it, and we've interviewed Toby a few months ago, it's striking to me that our nation has reached this level of killing. Just open assassination with no risk to Americans involved.
Well, this is a program which is designed to terrorize people both at home and abroad. It's a program which is designed to terrorize all of the people in the countries we're droning, and there were seven of them, Somalia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and probably left one out. Did I say Afghanistan? Anyway, there are seven countries that we are heavily droning, and the program is designed to terrorize the people in those countries so that they will be submissive and that they will agree to any kind of program that the United States wants to institute. It is also the case that the drone program and our continuous warfare program is designed to intimidate and terrorize people in the United States. If you speak up now, for example, Desiree Farous from Code Pink laughed at Jeff Sessions' hearing. She was arrested. It doesn't take much these days to be arrested. So people are afraid to speak up. People are terrorized into the goal of the program is to terrorize even people here in the United States into submission. And much of the practice for this terror program is being waged against people in black and brown communities and other communities of color in the United States. We practice in those communities, and then we try it out in the broader population. And so this is really a program which is to instill fear in people abroad and fear in people at home so that they don't speak out and that they just become accustomed to continuous warfare so that fear is normalized and people will do whatever they're asked to do. It's scary.
And police around the United States are investing in drones. Drones can identify you, follow your cell phone. They can, supposedly observation only at this point in the United States. But the Assassination Complex book, it just shows a suburb, an aerial view of a suburb in any city in the U.S. and how we can all be targets.
And actually what was just revealed, there was a leaked military video that was taken from a U.S. drone over the coast of Florida that was just tracking boaters. So the military was doing their training using the public as practice targets. I've always assumed that when we do our protests at Creech Air Force Base that the drones that are up in the air practicing are watching down at our moves. But to actually go into just communities and watch the public, it's a total violation. But more importantly, the fact that the U.S. military has these drones flying over other nations that we have no business being in and watching every move of people on the ground is an incredible violation on their sovereignty and on their right to privacy as human beings. How this ever was allowed to develop to the state it is shocking to me. We not only want the drone killing to stop, we want the global surveillance of the world to stop. The U.S. has no business to be the world's police.
KPFA is in spring fund drive right now, and we're offering this vital documentary, National Bird, as a thank you gift if you make a pledge of $110. And supporting KPFA is one way to get this kind of information out to the general public. It's a vital way in keeping these airwaves alive. I mean, we're talking to people all across Northern California, Santa Cruz to Fresno, way up in the North Bay, all the entire Bay Area. And this voice of truth to power is a vital institution to support. And we really ask you to call 1-800-439-5732 to pledge right now. We have a $500 match on the table. Every dollar you pledge is doubled in value. The National Bird film is $110 donation. The book, The Assassination Complex by Jeremy Scahill, is $90. The two of them together are $180. And we really hope that many of you will call in right now to KPFA. I want to play another clip and let you hear more, but we need to see that phone line start to light up a bit and really ask you to help us in that capacity by calling 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA, or you can donate online at kpfa.org. But we ask you to do that right now. It's really important. Toby and Eleanor, why do you think KPFA is important?
Wow, it's the alternative voice. It is a show in which people like us are invited to talk about the truth, to talk about things that you cannot hear about and you cannot read about in the standard press. It is a program in which there is debate. There are alternative views, even in the alternative radio station of KPFA. And where else do you get the opportunity to hear this multiplicity of voices and opinions? It's wonderful.
I'd also like to add that KPFA, I feel, strongly has influenced me in becoming the activist I am. I've been listening to KPFA since the time I lived in the Bay Area for 30 years now, more than almost 40 years, actually. And I got very well educated by listening to KPFA, and I'm forever grateful. So we urge listeners to make as big a donation today as you can and support KPFA.
By calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-AKPFA, or you can do that online at kpfa.org. We ask for your help. We really need your help to keep this station alive, to keep the voices of truth to power out there and available, to have Toby and Eleanor be here with us in studio to be able to talk about what I've been calling the diabolical nature of drone assassinations. The United States, the assassination nation, it just doesn't ring true to me, and nor should it to you. And we have to point that out continually around this country. So the film is the National Bird. It's a 90-minute film. It features three young Americans who formerly worked for the U.S. military, and now they're talking about it. And we're going to hear a sound clip from one of them now. Daniel describes his experience working for the Air Force and what happened right after he left the military.
Before I joined the military, I was well aware that what I was about to enter was something that I was against, that I disagreed with. I joined anyways out of desperation because I was homeless. I was desperate. I had nowhere else to go. I was on my last leg, and the Air Force was ready to accept me. The people who defend drones and defend the way that they're used, they always say, you know, they protect American lives by not putting them in harm's way. But what they really do is they just embolden commanders. They embolden decision makers because there is no threat. There is no immediate consequence. They can do this strike and they can potentially kill this person that they're so desperate to get and to eliminate because of how dangerous, potentially dangerous, they could be to the U.S. But if it just so happens that they don't kill that person or that some other people are involved in the strike and get killed as well, you know, there's no consequence for it. When it comes to high-value targeting, every mission is to go after one person at a time. But anybody else that's killed in that strike is just blanketly assumed to be an associate of the targeted individual. So as long as they can reasonably identify that all of the people in the field of view of the camera are military-aged males, meaning anybody who is believed to be of age 16 or older, they are a legitimate target under the rules of engagement. If the strike occurs and kills all of them, they just say that they got them all. People oftentimes get mixed up in the anti-drone movement, trying to say that we should just ground drones and we should just eliminate drones from our lexicon and never allow them to exist in this world. It's just too dangerous. And I don't necessarily agree with them, because drones are going to be a part of our life here pretty soon. They're going to be, most likely, they're going to be doing things that we were only able to do with people in a plane before. It would be like dusting crops or planting seeds or doing humanitarian surveillance during floods and disasters to try and locate victims. You know, they're going to be there. But there's also that other dangerous side to them that makes war so easy and so convenient and so simple that the people who have access to this technology and access to this capability just say, well, why wouldn't I use this? It's too easy. The most disturbing thing about my involvement in drones is the uncertainty. If anybody that I was involved in kill or capture was a civilian or not, there's no way of knowing. Nobody ever thinks about speaking out against the government who's worked for them and hasn't considered what the possible consequences are. But I don't dwell on them because I don't want it to affect my voice. I don't want it to silence my words or to curtail my speech. I generally feel like they being the government, they being the Justice Department, they shouldn't hold that power over me. This ominous threat that they'll go after me in the same way that they've gone after so many people, especially since 9/11. When they arrived, it was actually just hours after I had turned in my badge and was finishing my last day. I had gotten home, was relaxing, had poured myself a drink, and somebody downstairs was knocking at the door, and immediately both people at the door, man and woman, shoved FBI badges in my face, pushed me inside into the kitchen, and immediately behind them came, I'd say, about 20 agents, basically all of them with pistols drawn, some wearing body armor. And at this point, I'm extremely scared. I didn't understand what was going on. Altogether, I think there might have been at least 30 to 50 agents in and out of the house at different points throughout the evening, taking photos of every room and of everything, searching for different things. Once they were done, they left, and I didn't even have a phone on me. I'm probably going to get indicted, and I'm probably going to get charged with a crime. There's probably a real chance that I'll have to fight to stay out of prison. I think it's kind of funny, a little ironic too, because so far I'm probably the only adult male in my entire family, immediate and external, that has not been to prison.
That was Daniel, one of the three drone vets profiled in National Bird. He's also appearing in National Bird as Jeslyn Rodak, the attorney who helps defend government whistleblowers. One of the points she makes is that whistleblowers facing criminal charges can incur legal bills of millions of dollars or more even before their cases go on trial. She really calls this a David versus Goliath situation. So we're in Fun Drive here at KPFA. This is Project Censored. With me in studio is Toby Blome and Eleanor Levine, both Code Pink activists who have been down at the Creech Air Force Base and protesting there and blocking the entrance to the base. That's one of the main places drones are managed, where they're flown from all over the world. I'm looking at Jeremy Scahill's book, and one of the chapters is about Africa and the numbers of drone bases that are there or available there, both for observation and for killing people, and how that goes through. Most of these operations go through Germany. They go through the military base Ramstein in Germany that connects to the entire Middle East through satellite, and it's micro cable directly to Germany from Creech. That's a global surveillance system with the ability to assassinate and kill you. I can't think of anything in any way that, that needs to be addressed morally by the American people than this situation. And you can help address that situation by making it more public by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HKPFA. Donate online to Project Censored. That's right, we are in Fund Drive, and we need your support. We need you to be actively engaged in supporting this station. You can pick up a copy of the DVD, National Bird, for a $110 pledge. I mean, that's less than $10 a month, folks. And you can put that on a credit card. You can get the book, The Assassination Complex by Jeremy Scahill and the staff at The Intercept. That has a foreword by Edward Snowden, an afterpath by Glenn Greenwald. And it's really quite an amazing book. Edward Snowden writes, these disclosures about the administration's killing program reveal that there's a part of the American character that is deeply concerned with the unrestrained, unchecked exercise of power. And there's no greater or clearer manifestation of unchecked power than assuming for oneself the authority to execute another individual outside of the battlefield context. That is certainly a solid statement by Edward Snowden about this book, about this DVD, and why Toby and Eleanor are here today in studio to address this. They've been the ones kind of on the front lines of challenging the military at the air bases around the country.
Yeah, there's been protests all over the country. In New York, there's a very strong ongoing resistance in upstate New York where Hancock Air Base is. And many states around the country have regular weekly or monthly protests. And we're all kind of interconnected with each other. But what I think the public needs to realize is this expansion of this horrible thing called the drone program is happening so fast. And as an example, under the Bush years, the average strike was one strike in 50 days. Under President Obama, in his two terms, he averaged one strike in 5 days. So that's a 10 times increase. And now, under President Trump, we have an average of 1.5 strikes per day. And this is out of control. And as far as I'm concerned, there should be thousands of people at Creech Air Force Base and these bases, even in Beale. We have monthly protests at Beale, just north of Sacramento. You can contact East Bay Code Pink at gmail.com to find out more. And join us. Every month we go up there for 2 days. We have an encampment because Beale, just in our backyard, is heavily involved in the targeted killing program. And two of the whistleblowers that are in this film were stationed at Beale, so they're coming from our backyard. And when will the public rise up against this? Because are we going to wait until 1,000 people per day are murdered? When does it stop? The vast majority of people murdered are civilians. It's undeniable. The U.S. will not admit it, but all independent research shows the vast majority are civilians. And there was one study that was done that 28 out of 29 people were unintended targets. We will continue our resistance. We need it to grow. We need to be stronger. And Eleanor said, you know, this thing is to terrorize us, to make us afraid. But I think that what's really important to remember is nonviolent action is the most powerful thing we can do. It helps gives us strength. And the military and the police, oftentimes they really don't know what to do with us because we're completely committed to nonviolence. And studies show that nonviolence is the way to create good permanent change in the world.
And I just want to emphasize a couple of things that it has to be said that the drone assassinations are just an example of extrajudicial killing. There is no jury. There is no opportunity to present your case. There is no way to protect yourself. The decision is made ahead of time about who's guilty or who we want to decide is guilty, and then the missile is fired and somebody is killed or maimed along with other innocent civilians. This is not a case of justice. The second thing I want to say is that we try very hard not to talk about use the term drone warfare, but rather drone assassination, because drone assassinations accurately describe what's going on. We're not at war with the seven countries that we are droning. It's an uneven killing field. We go out, the United States goes out, and it kills without authority. There is no war. It is only an assassination program. The third thing I want to say is that one of the reasons that it's hard to mobilize the American public against drone assassinations is that it's war at a distance. People, the drone operators, the drone analysts, and the rest of the team sit very far away from the targets that are being missiled to death. And the American public is being told that the separation, this geographic separation, makes our military safer. And in the end, it does not make our military safer, and it does not make our population any safer, because we have made so many enemies around the world, and especially in the countries in which we are droning. And these are people who are beginning to rise up. And many of these countries are now slowly, one by one, developing surveillance drone programs. And the chickens are going to come home to roost. We're going to find ourselves in a very sad and very scary situation.
One point that I remember you made a month ago was that we don't drone China. We don't drone Russia, because these things fly so slow that, you know, an ordinary plane could shoot them down. But we drone people that don't have those kinds of defenses. We drone people on the ground who are poor.
Who are totally defenseless.
And are defenseless, exactly. And that makes it, you know, an overt assassination program. It's not warfare. They can't fight back. That's what's really amazing to me.
Yeah. These are countries where the technology just does not yet exist.
I had one Vet for Peace describe it as that these people are just sitting ducks on the ground, and that's exactly how it is. And if you take the time to watch this film, which you should, they actually go into Afghanistan and interview some of the families and that have lost loved ones. And you hear the story of three cars that were targeted, all civilians. Many women and children were part of the 23 that were killed. And this is just one example of many of just total civilians being murdered. We need to rise up and stop this. That I can't live with myself without being involved to try to stop it.
Yeah, and there are so many lies that are told, as Toby said before, about how many intended targets are really identified. A lot of, I think The Intercept at one point, you can find in The Intercept that it's only 1 out of 10 targets that's really the intended target. And this has to stop. People have to realize that it may be assassination at a distance, but it's still assassination.
So we kill one person, and several more die on average, who could be just neighbors, friends. That's more than assassination. That's murder. And on a scale that is almost unimaginable. And here we are telling people, daily strikes around the world, and this is the United States of America, with a Bill of Rights, with a Constitution, with a supposed democracy, and we're allowing this to happen. We can't allow this to happen. We have to stand up and say no. This is the Project Censored Show on KPFA, and I'm Peter Phillips. With me in studio is Toby Blome and Eleanor Levine from Code Pink. We're talking about drone warfare. And we've been listening to audio clips from the documentary National Bird, which you can attain a copy of this DVD with a pledge of $110 to KPFA. Please make that pledge now by calling 1-800-439-5732. Your pledge helps keep KPFA going. You can hear these programs, Project Censored, Guns and Butter, Flashpoints, and many more by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, or donate online at kpfa.org. We really ask you to make that support now. We haven't heard yet that we got that match. And we had a $500 match from David in Santa Rosa. And we hope that we can get that and more in the next 15 minutes we have left in this program. The corporate media tells you what politicians and generals say. At Pacifica and KPFA, we work to bring you the voices of activists and the whistleblowers. Their stories don't fit the pictures the general and politicians want to present, so the corporate media doesn't carry their voices. That's why we go directly to you, our listeners, for financial support. And this hour, you're hearing the voices of three drone whistleblowers and anti-drone organizers. And please show your respect and your support for this kind of programming by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. This is really a vital information package that's available here. The DVD, National Bird, for a $110 pledge. The book, The Assassination Complex, by Jeremy Scahill and the staff at The Intercept, Inside the Government's Secret Drone Warfare Program, for a $90 pledge. Both together are $180. We ask you to participate in telling the truth to the American public. I mean, thousands of people are hearing the station right now, hearing this message, and we need you to help continue that, to support KPFA by calling 1-800-439-5732. We want to go to a third clip here from the DVD. We're going to, this is a clip from the National Bird, and we're going to hear Lisa and her parts of interview from the film after leaving the military. And she decided to, why she decided to go to Afghanistan.
When I first got into the military, I mean, I was thinking it was kind of a win-win. It was a force for good in the world. I could actually help people. I could go places. I could learn things. There was nothing negative about it at the time that was in my thinking or in my consciousness. And, you know, I thought I was going to be on the right side of history, and today I don't believe I was. I worked on a DGS, a distributed ground system. As the name implies, I mean, it's a distributed system, and it spans the globe, and it eats data, and it eats lots and lots and lots of data. This is global. This is getting information anywhere at any time, shooting people from anywhere at any time, and it's not just one person sitting there with a little remote control, a little joystick, moving around a plane that's halfway across the world. That's not all there is. It's like borders don't matter anymore, and there's a huge system that spans the globe that can just suck up endless amounts of your life, your personal data. I mean, this could grow to get so out of control. And we're not the only ones that have this. This is going to be commonplace, if it's not already. It's a secret program. And what that means is that I can't just go shouting off the hilltops telling the public what it is. What I can tell you is that to me, one person who worked within this massive thing, it's frightening. There's a bomb, they drop it. It explodes. Then what? Does somebody go down there and ask for somebody's driver's license? Excuse me, sir, can I have your driver's license, see who you are? I mean, does that happen? How do we know? How is it possible to know who ends up living or dying? One of my neighbors, her name's Asma, and she was born in Afghanistan. And she goes there every year distributing seeds and doing humanitarian work. And Asma's willing to take me this year, and it's a beautiful thing. I'm aware that Afghanistan is a dangerous place. I'm aware that there's still war going on there. But I believe that doing this is the right thing to do. I lost part of my humanity working in the drone program. And humanity was what was missing there. And seeing these people as human beings. When I meet these people,
Part of it is making reparations for my participation in a program that's a huge, huge weapon system that kills more innocent people than actual targets. There's no way that I can make amends or change anything that I've participated in. But if there's any way that I can somehow give back to that country, that's what I want to do. I want to be able to be helpful, even just a little bit, by talking to somebody who's been directly impacted by the drone program and asking, what do you need? What do you want people to hear? How can I be helpful? Because being a part of a weapon system can't be helpful. It can only be hurtful.
That's a piece from the National Bird, the DVD, which is a premium here at KPFA today, which should be in everybody's home. And share it with your entire family. Share it with your church. Share it at your children's school. Share it in general so that we have an understanding and can see the realities of this assassination murder program being done in our name worldwide. It's appalling for many here. And, of course, you can reinforce your knowledge of this by not only watching the film and putting a pledge in for $110 to KPFA today by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. We need you to do that, keeping KPFA alive, keeping us this voice, this opportunity to tell the truth, to speak this truth to power, to call our political elites what they are, murderers. There's no other way to say it. And then when we allow this to happen in our name, we're complicit. We're part of the problem if we can't speak out and engage in saying no to this. And it's not just writing letters. I mean, you could write letters. We can try, you know, to educate people. But we also have to make that sacrifice of opening our wallets to support where the biggest opportunity to tell people can be, and that's KPFA here in Berkeley. Tens of thousands of people listen to this radio station, and they don't hear this message. You don't see this message in the corporate media. You don't hear about drone strikes in Afghanistan unless they say, oh, well, we killed a bunch of militants today. And that's how it's described, and maybe a little paragraph in the back of page 6. That's not right. And Jeremy Scahill lays this out in the assassination complex, the chain of command of how people are selected to be killed. Thousands of people are on this potential list. If they can identify them and follow them on their cell phones, if they use a cell phone, their SIM card is identified, then they're followed. Just like the police do here locally with the Stingray program, where they can pretend to be a cell tower and your phone will light into them and then they can follow you wherever you are. That technology is here, and the idea of drones are borderless means that we are all the chickens and being subject to review and monitored. It's frankly scary. It's one of the scariest things I think I've looked at this year. And so we have the book, The Assassination Complex by Jeremy Scahill. We have the DVD, The National Bird, both for $180 pledge. We'd like to see some of those coming in. This is a way to educate yourself, educate others, by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, and raising money here for this station to support us. With me in studio are two Code Pink activists, Toby Blome and Ella Levine, who I'm going to ask to say why they think it's important that we must do this.
Well, first of all, what's on my mind right now is the emphasis on the civilians, which is the most tragic side of this whole story. But I also want to address the militants don't deserve to be assassinated and executed either. The U.S. is the aggressor in these countries. We've invaded. We've occupied. Afghanistan is one of the very poorest countries in the world. We've been there for 16 years. And, you know, we carried on the Vietnam War for 10 years with the threat of communism scaring America. We ended the war and communism didn't spread around the world. You know, whether it would have been good or bad is another subject. But, you know, ISIS is not a threat to the United States or the public. I think these countries have to figure out their own problems. We helped create ISIS. Like, getting out of these countries will help, you know, in all these other, it'll bring down, as the drone whistleblower said, you know, the number one thing causing extremism in the world is terrorism. And I just want to say, Peter, I especially want to acknowledge these very courageous young people who've come out of the drone program and are speaking out, and particularly want to praise Brandon Bryan for being the very first drone operator to publicly speak out against the drone program. He to be the first one took a lot of courage, and these people are wounded soldiers, and it's going to take them a long time to heal, but part of healing is being able to talk about it and making these crimes against humanity so public. So I praise them. I appreciate them deeply. I hope that we can all work together to end this craziness.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness. The Life and Times of Utah Phillips, How I Became an Activist. When the great storyteller, folk musician, organizer, and activist Utah Phillips stood up in a small church in Berkeley in the summer of 2004 to tell the story of his life, he said that he never put it all together quite like this. Born in 1935 into the Great Depression, he learned about activism and politics at an early age. His father was a communist youth organizer and his mother a labor activist in the rubber factories of Akron, Ohio. Utah Phillips died on May 23, 2008, in his home in Nevada City, in the Sierra foothills. His passing generated a flood of letters, news stories, and songs from across the country. 4 years earlier, he had spoken in Berkeley, California, about the events that shaped his life. You can see why he is now remembered with such admiration and affection. Here is Utah Phillips.
My mother was a single mother with two little kids.
And where do you get, in the Depression, the tail end of the Depression, where do you get work? You know, coming into the Second World War. She got a job as a fashion model for Higbee Brothers downtown, walking the runway at noon, modeling Garbo hats. You know, I still have her publicity photos. You know, she did Motorola ads for Life magazine. They used to call them long-stemmed American beauties. That's what she was, this red model. That's where my love affair with trains began. My brother and I would sneak down the elevator in Terminal Towers there through Higbee's department store to the basement where the great trains came in, the huge steamers, the Nickel Plate Railroad and the New York Central. It's giant passenger locos, and there was a great rumble and roar under there in one aisle after the other. And you could stand there, and when the engines would get ready to go and the drivers would turn to get their purchases, it would vent a huge, enormous cloud of steam that completely envelop you. You know, it's just hot, other world, completely separate. And then the conductor would yell, "Board!" And I'd say, "No, I'm having the time of my life." My mother was courted off of the runway by a young Jewish businessman by the name of Sid Cohen. Just out of the University of Pennsylvania. He was a movie man. He'd run the Liberty Theater there on 105th and Euclid in Cleveland. He ran the last vaudeville house in Cleveland, the Hippodrome. And my mother, they fell in love, and my mother married them, and then I was adopted by Sid Cohen, being my brother. And we moved into the old Jewish neighborhood, the old Jewish ghetto in Cleveland, Oroville Avenue, 105th and Euclid. Ashkenaz, Yiddish-speaking. My grandfather, Simon Bialobzewski Cohen, was a Polish-Russian Jew, very, very conservative. That neighborhood was loud. That neighborhood, nobody would think of coming downstairs to ask a question. But would yell. When we moved to that neighborhood, I thought everybody was mad at everybody else. It just sounded like they were all angry with each other. No, they were just loud. God, it was loud. And still, with the rag man, with the milkman, and with the vegetable man, still horses in the streets, because by that time, with gas rationing in the Second World War, and they just didn't bother to give up the horses. So, and bring in the coal in horse wagons. But it was a loud, juicy neighborhood, a wonderful neighborhood. And then at the end of the Second World War, we spent part of the Second World War we spent in Dayton, Ohio. My stepfather was in the Army Air Corps. We lived in a cooperative village that had been built by the CIO called Greenmount Village, where he bought shares in the village instead of buying a mortgage on a house. It's still there, and the fees are still the same as they were in 1943. It's an astonishing place. You can visit it sometime if you have a chance. Back to Cleveland, there was no work. Post-war depression, my stepfather had trouble finding work. So he finally took a job with Paramount Pictures in Utah. And he moved the family to Salt Lake City, Utah in 1947. That was the 100th anniversary of the Mormon Pioneer Trek. And everything in that damn state was Mormon pioneers, and it was like landing on a different planet. I mean, coming from this Jewish neighborhood to the Salt Lake City was, God in Himmel, what can you say? But he took over Paramount's theaters, managing all their theaters from the Mexican border to the Canadian border, Intermountain Theaters. Interesting thing that happened then, you know, a gradual awakening. And my mother was still the red. Ever see Andy Mame with Rosalind Russell? That was my mother. She was loud, flamboyant. She read everything and let you know it. She was perpetually right, and she never converted. She was still a shiksa. She took on being a Jewish mother and beat it to death. Honest to God. I mean, she became the president of the Council of Jewish Women and never converted. She edited the council cookbook, for Christ's sake. You know, how did she do this? I don't know. She could do that. When we moved to Salt Lake, the theaters were segregated in Salt Lake City. They were segregated in a quiet way. There was a rope in the lobbies, and people of color, Native Americans, went up to the balcony. That was intolerable to my mother. There was a very famous event in Utah that was sort of subliminally known by Mormons called the Mountain Meadow Massacre. And it's when the Fancher Party were massacred by the Mormons. There's a whole long story behind that. met down by Cedar City, Utah. And then, except for some kids, were parceled out among people around there. Juanita Brooks, a wonderful writer, the founder of the Federal Writers Project during the Depression, by the way. Juanita Brooks wrote a book called Mountain Meadow Massacre. It was bought by Paramount to be made into a movie. Well, one of the council of the first presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Mormon, came to my father and said, you know, this is was a terrible thing. Nobody really knows what happened, but if this movie was made, it would be a source of considerable embarrassment to the church. And my father said, I'll talk to Paramount, but if we cancel the shooting, you have to let me drop the ropes in the theaters without opposition from the church. And that's how they integrated the theaters in Salt Lake City. And that's when Paramount made the Oxbow Incident as a substitute for the Mountain Meadows, which has yet to be made. I belong to the Jewish Organization of Youth. The Boy Scouts weren't integrated. Black kids couldn't go into the Boy Scouts. They were in the Mormon wards. So my mother helped start the Jewish Organization of Youth in Camp Elohim. I went to Camp Elohim as a boy. Camp Elohim, the Jewish youth camp, met in the summer at the Presbyterian College, Westminster, and my camp counselor was a Japanese-American, Tetsuo Okada, who ran a French bakery, Pierrot's, was Salt Lake of the time. That's when I started, quote, running away to Yellowstone on the freight trains. There was no other way to get there. And it was easy to hop the freight trains, you know, get out of the rope yards, going north. UP was could be difficult, and I get thrown off a good bit. But I was working on road crews. A lot of these old guys shoveling gravel, mainly old alcoholics who moved around in crews during in season. And all they could do was shovel gravel anymore. But they had guitars, and they sang old songs. I played the ukulele at the time, doing Erzak's Johnny Noble, Lovely Houlihan's Kinkamehameha, third wave Arthur Godfrey ukulele music, and a little box with buttons on it. Remember those things on my ukulele? And those guys, late at night in the clapboard bunkhouses or around the fires, showed me how to tune my uke chords into guitar chords. But you see, they were singing songs. Old Gene Autry and Goble Reeves, Hobo Jack Turner. They were singing songs that were closer to what I was feeling, what I was doing, where I was right then, than the Hawaiian music was. So that's when I started listening and started learning those songs, and that's when I started making up songs about what was going on around me. It was on one of those forays that I met a delegate from the Industrial Workers of the World, an old IWW. He was on one of the road crews. Now, he packed the rigging. He had the rigging. He could fill out cards, but he didn't know if the union still existed. You know, he had a vague address in Chicago someplace. He didn't know if it still existed. He filled out the card. This is now my 50th year in the IWW, and still my proudest association as a being a Wobbly. I did kind of run away. I ran away to a place called St. Christopher's Mission to the Navajo down in southern Utah. Bluff, Utah, on the bank of the San Juan River. There were no paved roads through there then. It was by Monument Valley. Do you know what I'm talking about? Four Corners, Chinle, Wash, Montezuma Creek, down through there. There was an old man down there by the name of Baxter Liebler, Father Baxter Liebler, the Padre of the San Juan. Well loved by the Diné people, by the Navajo, well loved. Father Liebler didn't go into their family mission, which is way to hell, and gone out in the desert to a little cloister and a log church that he built with his own hands. When he got the call, he went to Cornell University and learned Navajo from Gladys Reichard. He learned Navajo religion and mythology. And he went down in there, not with a mule and a Bible, but with knowing where he was going and who he was going to be with. He wore the Navajo bun, became an elder among the Diné people. He had three sung masses a day, using the plain psalter. But he used the words, but he used Navajo and Zuni medicine chants. And I was married in that church, in his church, a young woman that was down there studying anthropology. And he did the whole ceremony, and then he invited Randolph Benale in to do the Prince's Cornflower Ceremony. He was the medicine man from that valley, you see. That altar, that space was equal, shared equally. He was the first of my true elders, the first one that taught me that I was going to learn more paying attention to my elders than I was going to learn from school books, that I was going to learn from media, that I was going to learn from newspapers, that I would have to seek out my elders if I was going to learn something about the truth, about how to get through the world with some skill, with some panache, and with some idealism. I still didn't have any skills. When I got back from the Marian and I got back from St. Christopher's Mission, so what I do, I wanted a service school. I wanted to join the Army to get a service school so I could get a skill, and I got pipelined for Korea. And there I was, you know, a grunt in a troop ship Mitchell, 30 days at sea, going by boat, wound up at Incheon, wound up at Bang Ma, Wupyeong, Kumari Gap. It was there right after Panmunjom, right after the truce. But it was a sea of ruins, absolute sea of ruins. And that's where it begins for me. That's where the deep-seated anger, which I have been taught to cherish, to never abandon, it's not going to go away anyway. It's a motor. It's an engine. The anger in me is how I use it, how I animate that. That's the important thing. I could and have been a very violent person. I've had to learn how to take that anger and make it work in different ways. Korea was a sea of ruins. Korea was a small house with 100 babies in it, living on a 100-pound bag of rice a month, and they were all GI babies. It all had GI fathers who had gyroed home. The Korean government would have nothing to do with them. The American government wouldn't acknowledge them. I tried to raise money with my unit for them, and I got money. Men by my commander said, this is a terrible thing, but eventually be a good thing because it will raise the intelligence level of the Korean people. That's the kind of thing that I was dealing with daily. Shoeshine boys coming to our fence, and then when they were shooed away, going out and digging a little hole in the dike and the rice paddies drained because it was winter, and build a little fire to stay warm, and I would go into the guard towers to spot the fire so I could take a canteen cup full of cocoa and tea out, and going out one morning and find one of them frozen, little boy frozen to death, carrying him back in, giving him to the Katusas, the Koreans attached to the U.S. Army. And they took him, but I could see the way they looked at me, how much they hated me, how much they didn't want me to be there. Trying to swim in the Imjin River to wash it all off, to wash off all of the decay, the rot, to wash off this unlimited license for excess of all kinds, sexual excess, violence, booze, drugs, what have you, the blueprint for self-destruction, the blueprint for manhood, that had been given to me not just by my Army sergeants, not just by Korea, but by my gym instructor, by my camp counselors, by my own father, you see. I wanted to abandon it. I wanted to swim in the Imjin, but I couldn't do it. Regulation. Why? Yoon Seok-han, a young Korean who spoke English, said, when we get married in our culture, the young people move in with the grandparents. But there's devastation, there's nothing growing. So when the first baby comes, somebody has to leave. And it's the old man. The grandfather will go sit on a blanket with a jar of water on the bank of the Imjin River and die. And then roll down and be carried out to sea. He said, you can't swim in the Imjin because those are our elders being carried out to sea. Well, that was when it was done for me. That was when it was over for me. And I started running away to Korea House. Koreans trying to give GIs a better vision of who the Korean people were. They took me one night in the driving rain through the ruins of Seoul City up to the AWA Women's University, and it was beautiful. Been knocked about badly. There were holes in the ceiling of the auditorium, and the rain was coming through. Clyde lights set up in a, you know, grotesque kind of way. I don't know why I was there. This was all Korean students. And the person singing was Marian Anderson, the great black coloratura soprano. And she was on a tour of Asia. And I was in the balcony with the rain coming in between me and her singing. She was singing, Oh Freedom. and all those wonderful spirituals that she could sing. And I remembered back to Salt Lake when my father put me in the car. We went down to the Union Pacific Station to pick Marian Anderson up to come and sing at the Capitol Theater. We took her to the Hotel Utah, the best hotel in town, owned by the Mormon Church, and she couldn't stay there because she was black. And I remember her humiliation and my father's humiliation. And there she was in front of me singing. And that's when I said, this is all wrong. Everything is all wrong. It all has to change. And that change has to begin with me. And that's where it begins. I got back on the troop ship Mitchell, 35 days at sea. My marriage had fallen apart. Boat mail. A month for a letter to get home and a month for the reply to return. Things just fly apart. I got on the freight trains and I rode, and I rode seriously, and I rode drunk most of the time. I was on real serious self-destruct, acting out. I had a violent life. I wrote songs I will never find again, scattered about. I hit the bottom crossing the Mississippi River. I think it might have been MKT. No, I think it was on the Frisco Road. Into the East St. Louis yards. I was lying on a flat car with my belt holding run through a davit hole, so I was kind of lopped over the edge of the car. I did, so I had tied on so I wouldn't roll off. I thought I was pretty drunk. And I could look down into the water, and there were chunks of ice floating by. And I thought that if I could reach into my pocket and get my pocket knife, I would cut that belt and fall into the water and sink like a stone. But I couldn't get my hands to move. They were so cold, you see. So I wound up on the other side. It's at that point that I decided I had to make a stand. I had to go back to Salt Lake. And I had to make a stand. I had to make a stand doing something. Deal with the anger and the loss. I got a job in a warehouse. Western Movie Supply down there in 9th South and I think State Street. Elder Earl M. Lyman, elder of the Mormon Church, the second of my great elders. I had a big roll of butcher paper there. I was wrapping packages on a long table. Old Earl Lyman would get in there, and he was grandson of Amasa M. Lyman, one of the pioneer apostles of the church, and he would hoist himself up on the table and lean up against my butcher paper and talk about the old Mormon days, the old stories, the Morosites and the three Nephites, the Gadiant and Roberts, all of those great stories. I would go to the library at night and read Mormon history so that I would have questions to ask him the next day. Because I'd ask him questions, he'd get up on my table and start telling stories, and I couldn't work with him leaning against my butcher paper. That's how I learned the value of storytelling. But I learned some wonderful stories from the old Mr. Lyman, Earl M. Lyman. I was delivering packages one day down to under the post office. And I looked under the bush by the door, and there was an old man sitting there. He had a big picket sign. He was drinking water out of a gallon jug of water. The picket sign was against war taxes. Well, that fella, after repeated visits, finally I decided to sit down and find out who this is. Well, the fella sitting there was named Ammon Hennessy. Ammon Hennessy from the Catholic Workers. Ammon Hennessy had been sent out by Dorothy Day from the Catholic Worker House in New York to start the Joe Hill House, House of Hospitality, there in Salt Lake City, named for the great wobbly songwriter. Ammon took me in. Ammon was the third and principal of my elders, was the one who saved my life, quite literally saved my life. He dragged me out on a marathon picket line. He stood me up in court with him a number of times, picketing illegally against war taxes. And the judge Ritter would say, he never played innocent or guilty, he played anarchy. And the judge would say, hell, what is an anarchist? What is that anyway, Hennessy? He'd say, well, an anarchist is anybody who don't need a cop to tell him what to do. He's a fundamentalist anarchist, you might say. I learned a whole lot in that house. For one thing, working with Terry Sullivan and Pat Rusk and the other Catholic workers, what I learned was that if you were going to persist in the things that Ammon could do, pushing a grocery cart 60 blocks a day to get unlabeled cans from the grocery store so the people in the house would have something to eat. And these were mainly tramps off of the freight trains because we were out by the Roper Yards of the Denver Rio Grande and Western. Terry Sullivan especially, where do you get the moral, spiritual, and physical economy to do that year after year? Terry said, anybody can go out and get food. Anybody can go out and get clothing for a clothing barrel. But where do you get the spiritual and the physical economy to do it day after day, year after year? Huh? Boy, that's worth looking for. You know, I've been looking for that, building that. It's something that you build inside yourself. Got good teachers to do it, too. Ammon was an anarchist. First thing Ammon decided was that I needed to become a pacifist. Ammon said, you act out a lot. You brawl a lot. You're not any good at it. And you're the one who keeps getting pushed through the door, and I'm tired of fixing it. So you got to become a pacifist. And I said, how's that? He said, well, he's the one who convinced me. He said that it's like alcoholism. He said, alcohol will kill an alcoholic unless you sit in a circle of people that are like that and have the courage to put your hand up and say, hi, my name is Utah, I'm an alcoholic. See? But then you can begin to deal with the behavior once you own it, acknowledge it, and you can begin to have it defined for you by the people whose lives you destroyed. And it's never going to go away. 20 years sober, you're not going to sit in that circle and say, I'm not an alcoholic anymore. You're going to put up your hand and say, my name is Utah, I'm an alcoholic, but it'll save your life. He said, you've got to look at your capacity for violence the same way as a social addiction. And you've got to learn to deal with it in every situation, every minute, for the rest of your life, because it's not going to go away, but it'll save your life. Little different way of looking at pacifism, isn't it? See, little different way. I have to be a pacifist for the same reason an alcoholic has to give up booze. Okay, same thing. Mandatory. I sure learned that earlier today, I'll tell you. An anarchist, he said, you love the country. You go in and out of town on these trains, you come back with wonderful songs about great people. You know you love the country, you just can't stand the government. He quoted Mark Twain, loyalty to the country, always loyalty to the government when it deserves it. An essential distinction I have been neglecting. So he said, your beef is with the state. You can't stand the state. And yes, my war with the state is deep and visceral and very, very personal. It's not anything I wish on anybody else, anything that I preach to anybody else. It's me and the state squared off together, and that's a fact. Well, after I saw what they could do, I saw what they did to people's lives. Ammon had his own way of looking at anarchy. We come into a world built on compulsive combinations, cultural compulsions, they're called, cultural forms that we inherit. We are not the architects of them. Coercive combinations, boss, employee, student, teacher, parental, marital, God knows. Coercive combinations, all we ever want to do is to become self-governing enough as individuals to be able to come together and create between ourselves voluntary combinations that reflect our needs as we define them and not as they're defined for us. He came to me one day and said, if you and I can agree to do the work of our world here in this Joe Hill house, you and I can agree to do the work of our world, our share. If you and I can agree to take only what we need and put back what we can. If you and I can agree to care for the afflicted. If you and I can agree not to hurt anybody. All the things you can't get from the boss and from the state. But if you and I can agree to do that in our small way, we can form that voluntary combination and begin to get the work of the world done without the boss and without the state. Anyway. So that's what I did. I learned to become a pacifist. I'm learning to become a pacifist. It never stops. And I'm learning to become an anarchist in the simplest form.
You heard the voice of the great storyteller, folk musician, organizer, and activist, Utah Phillips. His albums include Telling Takes Me Home, Long Memory with Rosalie Sorrells, and Fellow Workers and The Past Didn't Go Anywhere with Annie DeFranco. Utah Phillips died on May 23, 2008, in his home in Nevada City, California. I recorded him 4 years earlier at the Unitarian Fellowship Hall in Berkeley, California. That year, he had reduced his touring schedule for health reasons and started a homeless shelter in his rural home county. Hospitality House opened in 2005. Come back for the second part of this one-hour program. Utah Phillips remembered the founding of the Poor People's Party for Children, working with the Mormon Church, the Black Panthers, and Judy Berry, and how he became involved with the folk singers movement. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Radio Curious, I'm Barry Vogel. This week, we visit the Heard Museum in Phoenix, Arizona. Founded in 1929, the Heard Museum's mission is dedicated to educating people about the arts, heritage, and life ways of the indigenous people of the Americas, with an emphasis on American Indian tribes of the Southwest. Committed to the sensitive and accurate portrayal of Native arts and cultures, the Heard Museum has successfully combined the stories of American Indian people from a personal perspective with the beauty of art. They showcase old and new handwoven baskets, kachina dolls, and other art and cultural objects. The museum showcases the art and regalia of the Apache, Hopi, Navajo, Pueblo, and Yaqui people, to name a few. More than 2,000 items make up the museum's exhibition. Artwork ranging from pottery, baskets, beadwork, dolls, and paintings are on display. Our guest in this edition of Radio Curious is Deborah Kroll, the communications manager at the Heard Museum, who shared portions of the museum with me on December 10th, 2011. We began our visit and our conversation when Deborah Kroll introduced us to the museum and its unique features that reflect the evolution of Southwestern Native art.
We have some pottery here from ancestral Pueblo times, which is around AD 900 to AD 1000. And it has distinctive motifs showing lightning and rain and water, which is extremely important to people in the Southwest. You're going to see this repeated many, many times in our permanent exhibits. Next to the 1,000-year-old pot is about a 100 to 200-year-old pot with the little swirly water motifs of a river. And next to that are two newer pots, also with the river and water motifs. And then in the middle is a basket created by a lady by the name of Annie Antone, who happens to be a friend of mine from Gila River. But she's a member of the Dona'othan Nation. And the basket has the water motif in it. And so these are motifs and design elements that have come down to us through time that continue to be important to Indian peoples. The herd itself was started in 1929 by a couple by the name of Dwight and May Hurd. Dwight Hurd was a pretty successful businessman. He was actually a distant relative of May Bartlett, who was an heiress to what's now the True Value Hardware fortune. And they met and married in Chicago in 1895, and then they came out here shortly afterwards because Dwight had a lung ailment. And back at that time, this is where you came when you had bad lungs, because they thought the desert, hot, dry desert air was good for your lungs. And it turned out to be really good for his lungs, and he stayed here until he passed away in 1929. But as soon as they got to Phoenix, one of the first things they encountered was Native art. There were people on the street corners selling pots and textiles and other pieces of art, and they fell in love. They became intrigued, entranced, and they started buying it because they really liked it. They also employed a couple of Indian art dealers to buy more for them. By the time 1928 rolled around, they had 3,500 pieces of Indian art cramming their home. And so what are you going to do when you have 3,500 pieces of art cramming up your house?
Make a museum.
Yeah, build a museum.
Next, we visited an exhibit representative of the living stick fences, enclosing the yards around the homes of many of the native peoples of the Southwest.
This is the entrance to our permanent exhibit called Home, Native People in the Southwest. And the whole purpose of this is to show what home means to the First Peoples here in the Southwest. And just like there's a fence in front of the yard to anybody's home, well, this is the fence to our home. This is a specially commissioned art fence made out of pottery and art glass by Pueblo artists Tony Hohola and Rosemary Lone Wolf. Tony did the art glass, and Rosemary did the pottery. And it's representative of the living Ocotillo stick fences that are found in homes throughout the Southwest. The Ocotillo, of course, is prickly, and it keeps all the critters out, and it keeps the kids and domestic animals in. This fence is unique in that it's made of many colors. There's a lot of cultural references here. You're going to see dragonflies. You're going to see a talking stick, which is an Otham personal journal. There's birds in here, there's babies, there's men, there's women, there's lots of corn, there's beans. People can sit here for hours just to see what's here.
The talking stick with designs on it?
Mm-hmm. The designs are unique to each person. They would carve some special aspect of important memories of their lives that they wanted to remember. And there's only one original left in existence, because the tradition is that when the person passes on, that the talking stick is cremated with the person, because most of the Southwestern peoples practice cremation. So this is the signature artwork to our exhibit. And this was created by Roxanne Swensel. It's called Se Ping, or the belly button. And the home, of course, is the belly button of life. And what it depicts is a typical Pueblo family: mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, kids, babies, and they're all enjoying the meal together. The beans are in the middle. There's tepary beans in the clay pottery bowl. Roxanne Swensel is from the Santa Clara Pueblo in New Mexico, and she always creates her pottery people without clothes. The reason for that is so that they're timeless. It doesn't matter, you know, if she put whatever period clothing she put on them, they would be outdated sooner or later. And this way you're always free to imagine them in any time, whether it's in the far reaches of the past, in the far reaches of the future, or today.
We next entered the permanent exhibit, which Deborah Kroll said is organized along the environments and cultures of the native peoples of the Southwest.
When you first come, you're going to see two maps, the traditional homeland map, which shows how ancient peoples were organized, and the present-day tribal lands, which are the lands which are owned by the present-day tribes, which are pretty much the same tribes as in this traditional homeland map. One of the things that's really interesting to note is that the connection between culture and environment. For example, the culture that you find along the Rio Grande is a lot different than the culture that you find in Arizona's Central Mountains. For one thing, the peoples of the Rio Grande are agricultural people. They stay in one spot. They grow their crops, or they might supplement it by hunting. Whereas the people in the Central Mountainous regions tend to be snowbirds. They have designated summer homes and designated winter homes, and they go between those two homes through the seasons. They're different than the nomadic peoples of the plateau country in that a certain family or a certain band has an allotted area that belongs to them. It's kind of like the Kumeyaay people in California. They would have certain water courses that each band would go up and down as the seasons progressed.
Where do the Kumeyaay live in California?
San Diego County and northern Baja California Norte. And in fact, there are a lot of similarities between the river peoples, some of the Central Mountain peoples, and the Kumeyaay, because they're all Yuman-speaking peoples. And by the way, they're my relatives, because they are Hokan people and we are Hokan people in the Salinas Valley.
And your background is?
I'm a member of the Haklom or Halon Salinan tribe from Central California coast.
And you grew up in the Halon Valley?
Yep, I'm from beautiful downtown San Lucas.
We then meandered to an exhibit of the ancestral sites of the native people, of the area where four states meet, called the Four Corners.
What we're going to explore here are some of the environmental regions. And the first region we usually take people to is Ancestral Pueblo. You might have been to the Mesa Verde National Park, you've been to Chaco Canyon, you've seen cliff dweller homes up in the northern Arizona and southern Utah area, and these are those people. Again, they were agriculturalists, and one way that the archaeologists and anthropologists can tell, besides the fact that their descendants are living along the Rio Grande today, is that they left behind a lot of pottery. People who go migrate between summer and winter homes, and they don't have horses, and they don't have wagons, and they don't have roads, it's really hard for them to cart these heavy pots around. And that's why you see with the snowbird people, as I like to call them, is they have baskets. These people have pots. And these are the traditional black and white pottery. You do see occasional red pot in here. They were built on the twine coil concept, which is they would make a coil of the clay and then wind it around and shape it as they went. One thing that that's very important to note here is, again, water. A lot of these have water motifs. There's rain, there's lightning, there's swirling water, there's clouds, there's these up and down design aspects, which are clouds. These are all evocative of water, because water, again, is scarce in the Southwest.
In the difference between the white pottery and the clay pottery, Is the source of the material different with pigment added or not added?
It could be. Sometimes the clay up north tends to be a little bit whiter than the clay down here, plus which there are different materials like red ochre that you could mix in with these clays to make more of the red color. The black paint is generally like mesquite pitch or some other types of you know, locally available rocks that you can grind into pigments. Here's something that's really interesting. It looks like a modern travel mug, but it's actually a chocolate mug.
Where does the chocolate come from?
Well, they traded with it from people from Central and South America. There was a lot of trade routes. Indian people have always traded with each other. There are trade routes that go all the way from Utah down to Mexico and Guatemala and Honduras and back again, which is why you're going to see the occasional parrot pod around here, because people brought parrots up. Of course, they couldn't breathe, but they were prized for their feathers and they were prized as pets.
So putting the trade route activity into a time period, when would that be?
From time uncounted back all the way up to about 1200 AD. People have traded with each other for thousands of years.
Is there a concept as to why it stopped in 1200 AD, which was long before Europeans came?
Well, it stopped in this region because around 1200 AD, one of our periodic 100-year droughts started. And as the water sources dried up and there was no water for the crops and no water for the turkeys who provided food and feathers for blankets. People were starving and people were desperate, and obviously trade was the last thing on their mind. So the majority of these people migrated over to the Rio Grande, where there was a more permanent source of water. And probably once they got there, a lot of that resumed again. About the only thing that really and truly disrupted it for good was the coming of the Spaniards, which disrupted a lot of things.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Deborah Kroll, the communications director at the Heard Museum in Phoenix, Arizona. This is Radio Curious on tour. I'm Barry Vogel. Deborah, the concept of the home in the New Mexico Pueblos, is it different in concept from the Arizona Pueblos?
There's really only one Pueblo culture people in Arizona, and that's the Hopi. So between the Hopi people and the rest of the Pueblo people in the Rio Grande, there's basically no difference. The concept of home amongst other peoples might be a little bit different in that, for example, the Yavapai people are what I like to call snowbird people, because they had a summer home and they would have a winter home. And so their concept of home is more around the family and more around where they were going to be at any particular time. The Apache people, because they tended to be summer winter people, but they were more of the people who would travel from place to place and trade or raid or however other means they used to obtain resources. They are totally family-oriented people, and so home to them meant their family.
It's where the family is.
It's where the family
they move
is
about.
At that particular time, yes. But again, you see that home is always the heart of any home is the family. And so a lot of the heart of our native cultures is, how do we continue the family on? How do we sustain the family? How do we protect the pregnant women and the women who are nursing small children? How do we care for the elders who have the accumulated knowledge of their tribe, the history, the environment around them, and the keepers of the spiritual practices, which holds everything in place?
So could you share with us how the elders and the keepers of the spiritual practices are protected?
One way that they're protected is that in many, many tribal cultures in the Southwest, that the elders are always fed first. This ensures that they make sure that they keep that
that physical sustenance inside themselves. Elders don't tend to eat much, and if it's, you know, like what you see in other places where if it's a free-for-all, the elders would probably lose out and they would die a lot sooner. But and it's also a measure of respect, because we respect our elders. We revere our elders. We know that they are the keepers of our spiritual practices. They are the holders of wisdom. They know the cycles of the earth. They know the cosmos. Their role is to make sure that we younger members learn those as we gain wisdom and knowledge, and we're able to accept greater and greater realms of knowledge. The elders are the highest, have the highest stores of knowledge of all of the people in any particular band or community.
Are there particular ways in which children or younger people are identified to become the story holders?
I can't really speak to that in any other tribe. I just know in my particular tribe.
Tell us of yours.
Well, the Salinan people. There are certain families, you know, all families have their own little funds of knowledge, but there are certain families in my tribe who have, for lack of anything else, certain power and have a little more knowledge than others, and I'm privileged to be one of those. And so my mother knows a lot of the plant lore. She knows a lot about climatic cycles. We have a tradition in our family of clairvoyance where we know when things are going to happen, but at certain times it's kind of spotty here and there. And so those families obviously have a little more knowledge and a little more power than other families do. Other than that, it's just whoever has the most aptitude. One example are the two-spirit people, you know, the people who are gay, and it's mostly men. I'm not sure how they would deal with a woman who is a two-spirit, because back in the old days it would mostly be the men who had this. They were considered to be extra holy because they had both the man and the woman inside of them. A lot of them became medicine people or holy people because they were considered to have greater powers. And I know that in certain tribes here in the Southwest, that used to be the case, and it may still be the case, but I can't really speak to it as much as someone who has a more intimate knowledge of that tribe than I would.
Deborah Kroll, one of the issues that distinguishes many Native cultures from non-Native cultures is the position of women, the matriarchy. Can you tell us about that?
In Native cultures, as in other traditional cultures throughout the globe, after thousands and thousands of years, we have learned how to hold a balance of power between the genders. And one of the ways that balance of power is through the matriarchy. In many, if not most, Native cultures in the Southwest and in California and throughout the United States, the men have a particular gender role. They are the protectors, the providers. They are the ones who put their face out towards the rest of the world. They're built for it. You know, genetically, they're stronger, they're faster. They make good soldiers. They make good political leaders. But on the interior of our communities, the women hold a certain, you know, they hold the economic power. They hold the social power. The culture is almost invariably passed down through the woman, which is the reason why Native cultures survived in the midst of all of the upheavals through the boarding school era, the reservation era, the relocations, the dislocations, because the United States government, being based on that Judeo-Christian male dominance model, smashed the role of men. They thought if they could smash the role of men, they could smash the tribes. But they forgot that traditionally, in traditional societies, the women hold the power, the cultural power, the social power, the economic power. And so the women carried on with their cultural practices totally unmolested, totally left alone by the United States government.
And those powers survived.
Those powers survived. Yep.
and they're still here today. One of the strongest tribes that practices matriarchy are the Pueblo tribes, including the Hopi tribe. And in our Hopi section, you'll see how that all plays out with the Katsina dolls, which are teaching tools given to women and to young girls as they master the art of being a Hopi woman and then passing the culture down to the next generation. They are the ones who determine, you know, what fields are going to get planted for corn. They are the ones who basically rule the roost. They are the heads of their families. The men have a certain role in that they are the political leaders, the war leaders, but they have to defer to the grandmothers.
When you say they have a certain role, are you speaking in the current context or in more of a historical perspective?
More of a historical perspective. However, today in Hopi land, it's exactly the same as it was generations past. That the grandmothers still tell the men when to plant the corn and what fields to plant the corn in, and they continue on with the spirit. There are priests who are men, and there are priests, and they get the visions of which Kachinas are going to emerge from the Kivas that year. That's part of their role. But the women make sure that gets done, in other words. And so that's how the matriarchy basically preserved tribal culture all over the United States.
And here is an exhibit of Acoma pottery, which is particularly unique to Acoma.
Yes.
Can you tell us about it?
The Acoma pottery is distinguished because it has very thin walls. It's also, some of the motifs are a little bit different than other Pueblos. However, if you look closely, you'll still see the water motif. You see the birds. Birds will point you to where the water is. There's also the elements of rain, the elements of flowers. There's some parrots. Remember I was telling you earlier about the parrots that they brought up? And they're very highly sought after by collectors today.
I can see why.
Yeah, they're absolutely gorgeous.
Well, Deborah Kroll, I want to thank you for extending this time with us in a Radio Curious visit here at the Heard Museum in Phoenix, Arizona. And before we close, I'd like to ask you a few questions, if I may.
Okay.
And one is, can you tell us about a eureka or an aha moment in your life that's influenced you, that you rely on?
Well, there's been many, but one I think your listeners would really like to hear is, one time I was privileged to consult with a medicine man, a Kiowa medicine man by the name of John White Shirt Sr., Kiowa and Arapaho. Very, very, very holy man, very wise man. And in that half hour I spent with him, I learned so much about my own responsibilities, as a spiritual person. And I learned a very great insight into world culture. He says that he was sitting in front of his house one day on this front porch step, and there was the electric line that runs in front of his home. He says, and I had a vision. He says, now see it in your mind. See that electric poles. And I go, okay. He says, now you see the wire going through and the electricity that flows through it. And I said, yeah. He says, well, that's God. He says, you see all those poles holding up the electric line and the electricity that flows through it? And I said, yep, those are the religions. That was profound. That was very profound. It really illustrates how all of us peoples, various peoples of the world, share that sense of the Almighty. And it doesn't matter if you call him Allah or Jehovah or God, or if you worship the goddesses that the English traditional people worship. It's still the Almighty. It's still God.
And can you tell us what you would like to do with the rest of your one precious life?
Well, I definitely am delving more into the responsibility of becoming a matriarch in my own sense. My mother is giving me more and more advanced knowledge of my culture, and I'm starting to take on more of the
roles of a matriarch and the responsibilities. And a lot of that involves not talking bad about other people, not wishing bad upon other people, always trying to look to the good. When you do a ceremony, you think good thoughts. And you think good, you wish for good things for that person. It doesn't matter if they've done you evil, if they're not in a good shape. The whole thing that you pray for is for them to heal. There's a lot of spiritual sicknesses in people. And one of the best things you can do is figure out how to lance that boil and drain out that spiritual illness. And that's what I try to do.
It's a nice thing. And finally, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
There's actually two books, because I know a lot of people that listen in from California, and a lot of the things that happen to people in California, or to the needy peoples of California, people really need to know about. And one of those books is called Ishi's Brain by Oren Starn. It tells the real story of Ishi and also gives a lot of the knowledge of what's happened to California Indian peoples. And the other one is a book that Kent G. Lightfoot wrote. You know, he was the former director of the Phoebe Hearst Museum, called Indians, Merchants, and Missionaries. That is one of the best historical books about the differences between the tribes who interface with the Russians and the tribes who interface with the Spaniards, and why when the Americans came, they dealt with those two sets of tribes differently.
Deborah Kroll, thank you very much for being with us at the Heard Museum in Phoenix, Arizona, on Radio Curious.
Well, thanks for doing this, Barry. We really appreciate your visit, and we hope that you come and see us again.
The Heard Museum is dedicated to educating people about the arts, heritage, and life ways of the indigenous peoples of the Americas, with emphasis on the American Indian tribes of the Southwest. The museum is located in Phoenix, Arizona. Deborah Kroll recommends two books, Ishi's Brain by Oren Starn, and Indians, Merchants, and Missionaries, The Legacy of Colonial Encounters on the California Frontiers by Kent G. Lightfoot. Our Radio Curious interview with Oren Starn may be found on our website. All Radio Curious programs are free at our website, radiocurious.org. Our phone is 707-462-6541. Email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onestad is our associate producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.